Hello and welcome to Beamcast. This is the October 25th edition of the ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
Please join the Shonen Beam social network. We are on Facebook, Twitter, my anime list. Always pop into IRC on Shonen Beam on the Ryzon network. And as always, of course, email the show, shonenbeam@gmail.com. We start obviously with some great news, at least as far as I'm concerned. Sket Dance is getting an anime. Sket Dance, the fairly long running, I believe, since 2007, Shonen manga series about the Sket Dan, the kind of the trio of students that help whoever is in need. It's a comedy combination, occasionally serious series, mostly comedy by Shinohara Kenta, former assistant to Hideaki Sorachi of Gintama fame. Finally getting an anime. Very, very excited about that. It's going to be this coming spring 2011. I know that neither of you are really big Sket Dance followers whatsoever, frankly, but I mean, just the concept of yet another Shonen Jump series getting an anime, is that a good sign for you?
Yeah, I mean, it just adds one more series to the list that people are following and has received an adaptation. So, like, it's one less thing that people have to wait on now.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a good thing. To me, it's a little bit worrisome because we are looking at a lot of these 100, 150 chapter series getting animated because they have less longer ones to flesh out to turn to. It's a little bit of a worrying trend, but obviously Sket Dance, if it's a quality manga, it deserves an anime.
Mm-hmm. I would certainly say it is. I think we need to put a countdown timer on the website, personally. I love that series very, very much. Another news, One Piece has passed 200 million books in print, so says One Piece. According to the wraparound jacket band on volume 60 of One Piece, One Piece, the entire franchise, has passed 200 million volumes sold, which, frankly, is no surprise. We saw it go, it was 189 a little while ago. We saw the last measured rank was at 195. I mean, it's been a little while coming, but we knew it was coming. But, I mean, no surprise, but still a very notable achievement, I would say. I mean, thoughts on One Piece, Clint?
Little known, but, you know, I guess for a small title, it does all right.
Yeah.
And I think One Piece is a pretty cool guy. He adventures around the world and isn't afraid of anything.
We have a new Shonen magazine set to release. Brace yourselves. This is called Sakura Hearts by the Japanese publisher Nihon Bungeisha. And they describe it as Moe X Moe. To be a little bit more specific, they're using kind of a dual meaning here. They mean Moe as in preciously cute combined with Moe meaning fiery. The first image that we have, this is on Anime News Network, the image shown, which I presume to be the first cover, is a cat girl and a bunny girl. So, color me not thrilled.
Going by our information, I'm guessing it's going to be about cute girls on fire.
Hopes not high.
Suddenly, I have higher hopes for it, if that were to be the case. Seriously, though, that... I am obviously not the target market for that. If it launches any series that are remotely relevant and translated to English, we'll talk about them. But boy, I'm not looking forward to that. In other news, Viz has licensed Ao no Exorcist to be released as Blue Exorcist, fittingly enough. Just a very small note there. It's a Jump Square magazine. So nice to see a little bit of recognition for the monthly series, which we see a little bit less of in terms of like the Shonen monthlies. It is a nice, I've been hearing really, really great things. Do either of you happen to read Ao no Exorcist?
No.
Nah.
Okay. I've heard, yeah.
There have been a couple, like, I'm more inclined to think that monthlies can do better with quality than I am with weeklies because there have been so many that we've seen.
Right.
Notably Full Metal Alchemist.
Yeah.
Soul Eater.
That being the biggest one, I think, FMA, in terms of translated success. In terms of some non-shonen news, it does bear mentioning. We won't spend too much time on it, but we have a couple different live-action pieces of information to mention. One of them being that Fruits Basket, puzzlingly enough, has been licensed for a Hollywood live-action adaptation, and the other one is that Universal and Illumination have gotten the rights to Urasawa/Tezuka's Pluto. Now, you read Pluto, Drew.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good series, but they still are about a year and a half behind of that monster movie's release date. So not even getting high hopes for it coming out. It's an interesting premise. I don't know how they would do it quite.
Yeah, I've heard some concerns over it being Universal specifically. I wonder about the fact that who has the license, how much that will affect the overall quality of the final work. Frankly, just the concept of all these different live action adaptations doesn't thrill me, because it doesn't really work. At least Hollywood live action doesn't work. To that point, though, I think Fruits Basket even more so. I mean, first of all, how are you going to make that work? But more importantly than that, why? You're certainly not capitalizing on the popularity of Fruits Basket.
Yeah, I just don't think these projects are ever going to see the light of day. I mean, we've seen things like this in the past with Cowboy Bebop and Akira, where right. we've had hints of a Hollywood movie. We've had actors even behind it, names to put to it, but it's never going to come out.
Yeah, I mean, when's the last time you recall like an anime adaptation Hollywood movie specifically coming out?
No.
Aeon Flux.
Yeah.
I don't... does not count in a variety of ways.
I mean, the amusing thing with regard to Fruits Basket and Bebop is the story that I read said that the person, not necessarily director, but like the person who's really foremost in charge of organizing this entire project of turning Fruits Basket into a Hollywood live action movie is apparently, quote, best known for his work on the upcoming Cowboy Bebop live action. I mean, he's best known for something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's...
There
are a lot of question marks behind a Fruits Basket live action, just even before you take out the production staff.
Oh, absolutely. That to me, that makes absolutely no sense. And especially just, again, you're not capitalizing on success. The timing of this is just completely astounding. But anyway, that is not actually shown, and so we ought to move on. The Oricon rankings for the week of October the 11th through the 17th. Number one this week is Fairy Tail Volume 23. With over 197,000 volumes sold. Number two is Triple X Holic, volume 18. Number three is Ahiru no Sora 29. Four is Daiya no E 23. And five is Bleach 47, which is still on the list from last week. Looking down the list, six is GTO Shonen 14 Days 5. Seven is Reborn 31. Continuing on, Gintama 36. 10 is Bakuman 10. Not seeing too much. Bloody Monday Season 2 is debuted. Number 5 debuted with about 50,000 copies. That's actually pretty good, come to think of it. Kimi no Yamachi debuted this week with about 40,000. But really, looking at the top, though, not too surprising in a Kodansha release week to see Fairy Tail at the top of that. Nice to see the sports titles getting some love, too. The Ahiru no Sora and Daiya no E combination right there. That's really appreciated. Release dates for this upcoming week, we have FMA second season of Viridian Collection on DVD for $49.98. Season 4 Box Set 1 Uncut of Naruto on DVD for $49.95, One Piece Season 3 Part 3 DVD for $49.98, and the entirety of Trigun on DVD for $49.98. As far as manga is concerned, we have Kuroshitsuji Volume 3, also known as Black Butler, for $10.99, Cirque du Freak Volume 7, if you read Arago, this is by the same artist, Codebreaker Volume 2 for $10.99, Hero Tales Volume 4 for $10.99. That is by the same author-artist as Fullmetal Alchemist, Hiromu Arakawa. Negima Volume 28 is $10.99. Pastel 15 for $11.99. Soul Eater Volume 4 for $10.99. And Zombie Loan for Volume 10 for $10.99. So some interesting releases sprinkled in there. Let's move now to the poll segment. Last week, we asked you, of the six, again, these Jump quote-unquote super legends that are all running one-shots and consecutive issues of Shonen Jump, we wanted to know which one was your favorite author. And some little-known nobody named Akira Toriyama kind of ran away with this thing. I'm surprised. I think we might have been trolled here by the internet or something. Who is this guy?
I was expecting Akimoto Osamu to pick up all those votes, so
yeah,
huge shock there on my part, but...
Okay, obviously, there's absolutely no surprise to this poll whatsoever. Akira Toriyama deservedly takes 47.5% of the vote at the time of this recording. Next, after that, is with 20% of the vote, is Sorachi Hideaki of Gintama fame. We have, following that, is Kishimoto Musashi of Naruto fame with 17.5% of the vote. After that is Takeshi Konomi, 10% of the vote. And then we have a tie between Osamu Akimoto of Kochikame and Kyosuke Usuta of Sexy Commando and Jaguar fame. Nice to see them at least get votes. I do appreciate that people out there are familiar with the work, especially Usta Kyosuke. I hope that we have some Jaguar and or Sexy Commando fans out there. As far as the poll question for this week, we were looking, again, we were talking about Sket Dance getting an anime. We know Beelzebub's going to have one. Bakuman just got one. So we're looking at a lot of anime adaptation issues. And so we want to know exactly like what's the next one that you people want to see turned into an anime. But we had to cut it off somewhere. So we're saying of the 100 plus chapter series, and we kind of personally narrowed it down to the ones that are very well known stateside, basically the ones that get scanlated promptly. Which out of these 100 plus chapter series is most deserving of an anime adaptation? And the contenders are Bloody Monday, Codebreaker, Kimi no Irumachi, Mixim 11, Siren, and Yankee-kun to Megane-chan. So, Drew, I'm going to turn that over to you first. What do you think?
I mean, to me, just the thing this poll immediately reminds me of was the Siren Bones hoax that fooled a ton of people over at Manga Helpers a while back, and that was funny.
That was very funny.
But in all seriousness, I think Yankee-kun to Megane-chan and Siren could both have very interesting anime adaptations. Siren is obviously not going to happen.
What about you?
I'd love to see Bloody Monday get adapted because it's something that I've kind of wanted to get into for a while, and that would definitely give me, like, a motivation to do so.
Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, Mixum 11 is the last one I ever want to see animated. What a pile of garbage that is. Bloody Monday, I think, to me, is kind of the runaway winner, frankly. It already has a drama series long-running now, so it is being noticed, but... such a brilliant series, and one that touches on a lot of elements that other shonen doesn't. I mean, yeah, you do see a lot of seinen series cover this kind of, like, terrorism, really mature storyline, but this is, for a shonen, this is kind of, like, redefining boundaries, so I'd love to see that one. Obviously, though, I mean, there's lots of strong contenders here. I'd love to see Siren, love to see Kimi no Irumachi, love to see Yankee-kun. All right, time now for the Great Shonen Tier List. Spoiler alert, as always. So we're going to begin from One Piece. We still don't have any immediately relevant characters to tier post-time skip. So once again, taking a look slightly backwards, we're going to tier Oars. You may know him as Oz if you are not familiar with the redefining of his name. His name was supposed to be Oars, so we will call him Oars. He is the huge zombie that Moria controls, the ancient warrior that has long been since dead. So looking at him, he's essentially just really, really huge, strong, suitably strong for his size, but he doesn't really necessarily have any particular powers. Are we going to tier him having Luffy's shadow and then also having Luffy's stretching ability to an extent?
Yeah, I think peak condition, we kind of have to.
Well, okay. Peak condition is like with Mariah co-oping him, so there is that.
I think, yeah, his own peak condition, I'd say we'd have to allow for that. That, frankly, probably wouldn't come into play too much, though. In that case, let's begin by taking a look in strong tier, because he's certainly a strong character. And I'm seeing there's a trio of Naruto characters right in a row, and then there's one a little ways down. We have Tsunade, Gai, and Kisame all in a row, in that order, descending. And then Gaara, a couple notches below Kisame. So let me pose it to you first, Clint. What do you think about Oars versus these Naruto characters?
I think the top three he loses to, I mean, Tsunade has just disaster-level striking ability, and she's going to get punches in on an opponent this huge, and it's going to wreak havoc. And then the other two, Kisame and Gai, both have, like, Afternoon Tiger and the Waterfall of Sharks, respectively.
I'm sure that has a name, but Waterfall of Sharks is so much cooler.
Can we just say Waterfall of Sharks?
Yes.
And then they all have that, and I think that gives them a little bit of a heads up on Oars, but I don't think Gaara has anything to stop Oars from, so I think he's going to go right between them.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Gaara's just sort of going to get into a punching fight, and he has a very visible weak spot there.
Right. Okay, so in between Kisame and Gaara, then, we have Natsu and we have Crocodile. Crocodile, largely similar to Gaara. I mean, there are some key differences, but is this pretty much the same skill set, same ability set, same result?
Yeah, I just don't think his powers have the scale necessary to take down this large of a foe.
Okay, do you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so. Even if he desertifies a little bit, he's still going to eventually just lose out to sheer body mass.
Okay. And then it comes down to Natsu of Fairy Tail. Natsu has the magic fire ability. What do you make of that fight?
I mean, like, when Oars fought, like, the characters in One Piece who were using fire and other elemental attacks, he sort of just shook it off. Took a whole lot of beating to bring him down, so I would be on the side of Natsu not being able to win.
That makes sense to me. I tend to agree. Do you have any input on that one?
I just think Oars is too huge for any of the techniques Natsu would be pulling out.
Okay. So we're going to place Oars right below Kisame, but right above Natsu. Next up on our list from Naruto this week is Akimichi Choji, who apparently is right below Akimichi Choji. taking a look, we have there's a lot of Naruto characters in mid-tier. to briefly define Shoji at peak condition, though, we'd have to say Butterfly, basically, when he's taken all three pills.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, yeah, we've seen him
pumping out a whole bunch of power.
We've seen him post-time skip a little bit, but even then, I don't think he's at that kind of reckless, you know, at the expense of my own life type of strength that we see before the time skip. Obviously, if you want to argue with that point, if you think that there's a different version of Choji that's more powerful, please let us know. shonenmeme@gmail.com. But let's start by looking in mid-tier, because we have several Naruto characters in there. So I'll ask you, Clint, we have Rock Lee, Neji, Shikamaru, Sakura, and Kiba in there currently. Do you think, again, as always, above, below, or somewhere in the middle?
Somewhere in the middle, around about. Choji is very much like a middle kind of character.
Okay. Drew, do you have any specifically idea where to narrow him down to?
Oh, yeah. To me, I feel that, like, he definitely loses to Rock Lee. Mm-hmm. Like, above, I think above Shikamaru is a reasonable estimate. I think he could power through the shadows. And
that's interesting. I mean, do you think that would be the same in-universe as out-of-universe?
I think that'd be a difficult fight to call, even if it was written in-universe. It would depend a lot on story circumstances, who won.
That's true.
If Shikamaru had time to set up a bunch of things, like in-universe he would,
and
then
he
maybe
would
he might
know Choji well enough to know his weaknesses.
Right, might come out on top there. But I mean, like, based on their raw abilities, if they were both just in an arena with each other, I kind of think that Choji with the three pills is a little too strong.
Okay. So the next highest Naruto character is Neji. Do you feel that Neji would take that one?
Yeah, I think situationally, Choji depends a lot on chakra for, like, just having the power to make his attacks, and Neji can seal off chakra points, sort of nullify butterfly mode.
Right. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Okay. Next on the list, downward, is Kukabara from Defense Devil. Another blatant power user tank, we've called him. I mean, how do you see that one playing out?
I mean, they're both characters who, in a way, have a time limit on their ability. I just think what we've seen from Choji, just, like, totally decking another power character in series, I think that's enough to out-tank Kukabara.
I could see that. Let's make sure that's not just a tiebreaker matchup issue, though. Apachai from Kenichi, what do you make of that one?
I mean, for this, even without the pills, he has, like, the large mode becoming super large, and I just don't know if Apachai has a way to deal with that.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So I'm thinking we put him right below Neji. Does that work?
Yeah,
okay. I guess that works.
Again, we don't like to put characters from the same series just next to each other because it seems like a cop out, but sometimes it just happens to fit. Let's introduce another character from JoJo's. He's belonged on the list for quite some time. Dio Brando, one of the most badass, or even just bad, villains ever. But the issue, we kind of postponed it, not because of relevance issues. I mean, he's extremely relevant, but just because of similarity issues. Because already on the list, we have Kujo Jotaro of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure Series 3, which is where he was introduced. And if you know that series, you know that Dio is almost identical, frankly. I mean, if you look at the power sets, they can both stop time. Yeah, they do it in a slightly different fashion, but the method that they use to start up the time stop is exactly the same. So it's not as though one of them would have, like, a handicap. So, I mean, I'm looking exactly at Jotaro, and I think that based on tiebreaker as to in-series canonical fight, Jotaro wins, and yet there's no one that Jotaro beats that Dio wouldn't also beat. So to me, Dio just goes directly below Jotaro. Is that right?
Yeah,
that's a nice, easy tiering. We're tiering the ability to stop time. That's where it is.
Yep. Okay, so that was quick. Moving right along, Knocking Master Jiro from Toriko. Could you briefly describe the concept of knocking to anyone who doesn't care about spoilers and is still listening?
He uses essentially needles or, like, pressure points, but not really needles that pierce deep into the skin, and he can knock basically anything out. He knows where all those pressure points are, and, like, once you're knocked out, obviously you're helpless, and he can do whatever he wants with you.
Whatever he wants with you. This is Toriko, after all. This is a series about, like, beasts, but he would know the anatomy of pretty much anything, so it's not as though he would be at a handicap against humans as well. So for a character like that, we have Toriko, the character, way down in kind of in the dregs of mid-tier. But I'm going to start with Sani, actually, also from Toriko, who is near the top. He's second place in strong tier as of right now. Could you compare Sani and Jiro, please?
Well, Sonny is a powerful character for the ability he has with his hair. Mm-hmm. At the same time, like, I feel like Jiro's speed and skill with the knocking gun mm-hmm. basically counts as a mid-range projectile. And I feel that based on that and based on general superiority, battle savvy in-universe, he would top Sonny.
I would get that impression as well. Would you also?
Yeah, I just think he's a stronger character all around, but definitely with the knocking, he would come out on top pretty easily.
Okay, that could be a tiebreaker issue. We're not exactly certain, but let's presume it isn't. Boa Hancock is right above Sonny. Boa does have, you know, the ability to turn anyone who would love her, anyone with lust for her, into stone. They would be petrified. Would that have any effect? Would Jiro just be able to knock her the second that the fight starts and not even really be fallen prey to that?
Let me say this. No one in Toriko is going to fall for that ability.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's a good point.
Yeah, there's that, and there's the fact that not unless she was dressed as a sake bottle, because that seems to be his only real interest.
That's right. Yeah, but if you take that, the petrification idea out of it, then you're basically left with the idea that she has to use the heart, the visible heart projectile attack versus Jiro's knocking projectiles. And judging the two on their speed, I would say that definitely Jiro is way faster and takes her out.
I think Jiro's a lot faster, yeah.
He's okay. A solid quick draw.
Okay, so that right now would put him at the top of strong tier at least, but let's start to venture into high tier. We have Erza Scarlet as the bottom of high tier from Fairy Tail. And your thoughts on how that one would play out?
My thoughts, like, it's a question of speed. Does Erza get armor up in time? And I think she does. Like, one of her big points in series is that she can re-quip armor extremely fast. And
right.
At least as far as Adamantine, that would cover everything except her face. And that includes probably most pressure points that Jiro would go for.
Yeah, first of all, he would have to be so amazingly precise, because he would have to know to go for the face, which I would imagine that he doesn't usually do, and he would have to hit the face, whereas Erza would know that the armor that she's exquipping, re-quipping or whatever to, she would know that the only weak spot is the face, so she would not make it obviously hittable. So yeah, I think, to me, on adamantine armor alone, let alone maybe being able to fly away or what have you, I think Erza takes this. Now, we also have, let's make sure that's not a tiebreaker thing, we have Kurama, we have Magellan, we have Black Star and Tsubaki. We're starting to get really powerful really quickly here. Do you think that Jiro has any chance against these types of characters?
No, I think especially once you start hitting, like, the Black Star section and everyone above him, just Jiro doesn't have a chance against.
Any chance against Kurama?
Now, Kurama is potentially debatable, but I think the Magellan and the people above him, and just the fact that Kurama can bombard Jiro with a ton of projectiles and also traps coming up from underground and any number of things, I think technique takes that one.
Right. So if only on quantity tiebreaker, but most likely just overall, Jiro then would be below Erza but above Boa. So let's then determine, is Jiro in strong tier or high tier?
It seems to me to be a purely physical power that Jiro has, and that, to me, makes sense in strong tier.
I agree to you.
Yeah, that seems like a strong tier power.
Okay, Jiro is the new top of strong tier. Next up, from Katakyoshi Hitman Reborn, is Sasagawa Ryohei, the boxer in the Vongola Familia, because everything has to be in Italian. He just finished up his little mini fight in this arc, so we can kind of tier him right now. He's gotten upgrades to his existing future arc stuff, basically to kind of summarize everything he can do. He has boots that let him fly and be very fast in general, even if he's on the ground. He has, like, rocket punches with his new gloves. He has, like, a healing factor, kind of akin to a Wolverine type of idea, but certainly nowhere near of that level. Just even on his own strength, he is a very physically fit, very strong boxer. He has armor, essentially, not full body armor, but he has plate armor in places, logical places for a boxer where the weak points might be. And then his newest technique is kind of a counter ability, where anytime he takes damage, it's very video game idea themed. Anytime he takes damage, he kind of charges up this counter, let's say. And then at any point, he can release that energy in one of his attacks. So anytime you attack him, yes, you are damaging him, but you are also helping him out because you're giving him a reserve of attacking energy. So I want to look at, to begin with, last week we tiered Yamamoto Takeshi of the same series. He, to me, is far faster, far more maneuverable. I mean, yes, Ryohei can fly, but we don't get any indication that he is that maneuverable or that fast. So to me, I'm not even thinking anywhere in the same category as that. And even frankly, as Suna, and once again, Suna can't be tiered as highly on our tier list as he would be in Universe because of his one of his attacks does not cross over outside of Universe. So I'm thinking that even without that power, Suna still beats him. So I'm looking actually in mid-tier. And let's start to get to some of the characters that you two know. Right below Suna is Crow from Dead Man Wonderland. Your thoughts on that power set that I explained versus Crow?
A supersonic blade probably cuts him. I mean, the armor might go a ways to stopping it, but I mean, it's a pretty powerful blade. It's not by any means just metal. It's blood blade.
So. Even if it didn't cut him, and he would still have the chance. It's supersonic. He'd have the chance to strike him 2, 3, 4 times before Ryohei would really be able to react. He doesn't have supersonic reaction time.
Right.
Right below that is Kagero of Kakashi.
Yeah, that I think Kagero goes for the killing blow right away, and his swords are certainly sharp enough that he gets it.
I think Gon and Alan Walker both have enough destructive power to take him out in one shot, certainly with the Junkin Goo, and then anything with the Crown Clown or Clown Crown, however you wish to order that. Stupid D-Gray man. Rekka from Flame of Rekka, I think, has enough firepower, certainly in the later dragons, if not even the earlier dragons.
Yeah, like even in like the Fireball Dragons or like just Saiha the Blade Dragon, I think that's enough by itself to just cut his head off.
Nura Rikuo and Yuki Onna both. I mean, I don't think Ryohei, kind of straightforward, kind of dumb. I mean, not like a stupid, stupid character, but, you know, certainly doesn't have like an awareness factor to be able to counter the illusions of Kyoka Suigetsu from Rikuo. And then what's he going to do to all-encompassing ice attack? I don't think anything.
Yeah, I don't know that he has an answer for that.
What about Akisame? That's a considerable drop-off right there from supernatural to a kind of comically superhuman, but definitely a lot more realistic. What about Akisame from Kenichi?
I think that does... Akisame could do submission holds, but I think between armor and especially being able to fly, I think he just has too many supernatural advantages that, like, a regular physical human can't hold down.
Yeah, I'm getting the inclination that Ryohei's going to take that one as well. Would you agree with that, Clint?
Yeah, I could see that being the place. He's just too not human for Akisame to handle.
Akisame is somewhat positioned where he is based on matchup issues, because if you look at Rock Lee, certainly Rock Lee way, way faster than Akisame, but martial arts wise, Akisame would be able to take him out. So let's look at another tiebreaker issue then. If Akisame was the tiebreaker, Rock Lee versus Ryohei, do you think that Ryohei still has enough in the way of like pseudo supernatural to take out Rock Lee?
Well, he certainly has the ability to fly. I think he has certainly... Rock Lee's going to be not doing damage in just one hit. He's going to be pounding him around, and that's right. Just going to charge Ryohei up.
That's a good point. And then there downward, we have Killua. He's fast, and he has the awareness thing, but there's not much he's going to be able to do to an opponent who's flying. At best, he would be a tiebreaker victory, and I don't even think that would happen then. I'm getting enough evidence there to say that Ryohei goes right below Yuki Onna and right above Akisame. And finally this week, we're going to add a long overdue Dragon Ball character of note, Gohan. Gohan is always an interesting discussion in terms of tiering characters, especially in universe, because Goku is actually heard saying, you know, my son is stronger than I am. So you always get that impression that Gohan is actually the stronger one. But as we've had to reiterate many times, we only tier based on actual evidence. We cannot actually tier based on hearsay, based on word of mouth, based on implications. There are certain assumptions that we can make, and one of them we'll make here. When Gohan uses Mystic Super Saiyan?
Yeah, he has a form of Super Saiyan that he achieves by, like, the Grand Kai or the King Kai.
Right.
Releasing all of his latent potential. And after that has been done, when he powers up to Super Saiyan, he doesn't gain, like, the spiky hair or the blue eyes.
Right.
His appearance remains exactly the same. And that form has been named Mystic Super Saiyan.
Right. Sometimes he's also called Ultimate Gohan. In fact, I am going to refer to that form as Ultimate Gohan because that is often used. And in that form, he is fighting on an equal level with Super Majin Buu. That's the form named Super Buu. Later on, I mean, there's an extenuating circumstance that leads to the end of that fight. Buu explodes. Later on in the series, Buu goes back into that exact same form, and both Goku and Vegeta realize they wouldn't hold a candle to him, Goku and Gotenks in Super Saiyan 3 aren't able to defeat Super Boo exactly the same. So that kind of like fighting against an exactly the same common enemy, that is an assumption I'm willing to make based on strength, because it's in universe they're fighting exactly the same character. That I can make a strength comparison. However, Gohan has never seen to learn instant transmission. And that is, speed is the ultimate killer in terms of our tier list. So I still don't think that Gohan goes up there with like the Goku, the Cell, the Boo. But what about Vegeta?
Vegeta, I think very clearly Gohan at the end of series is above Vegeta, like much to his chagrin as a rival. But Gohan definitely demonstrates more skill than Vegeta does when he's not fused with Goku.
Yeah. And does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I think Gohan in this form is better than any of the other Saiyans in their Super Saiyan 3.
Right. That said, I mean, we look at the characters that are immediately above Vegeta and now Gohan, potentially. We have, I mean, our top 10 is so hard to crack into because number 10 is Medusa. And that's vectors and every single thing that Gohan would be able to do. Again, if he doesn't have instant transmission, he doesn't have the trump card against being able to redirect vectors. So is there anything that he would stand a chance with against Medusa?
Yeah, I can't really think of anything. I mean, everything would just get redirected away.
What about the two characters immediately below that, Drew? Ichigo and Amamiya. Your thoughts on those?
Ichigo sort of has Mugetsu, and like even before that, if we're tiering peak Ichigo, it might just be the form that's owning Aizen. He might not even have to resort to that. Mm-hmm. I feel like the way we've seen him manhandling people, he's definitely like about as strong as Gohan, and based on our conception of speed in the two universes, he's way faster.
Right. And then Amamiya, I mean, she's going to get at least a free hit, is the way that we've established it with her clone, being able to kind of phase between the real self and the fake self and whatnot. And she has the dust, and that's combined with the whole like mind control aspect of her. I think you could look at it a variety of ways, but I think that she has too much of an arsenal and some techniques that are just way too powerful for Gohan.
Some techniques that can't really be blocked via raw strength.
Right. So to me, it looks like then, again, we're placing like one character from a series next to another from that same series, but Gohan right above Vegeta?
Yeah, it has to be that way.
Okay, so that is where he goes. That takes care of the tier list this week, and now it's time for anime discussion, and Drew's going to kick us off with Nurarihyon no Mago Episode 16.
Stupid losing at rock, paper, scissors, but yeah, this episode we saw a fight between two girls with hair powers and a dead rice ball yokai, and a little bit of Nuro's friends doing exercising. It was not a great episode. It was better than the second to last episode. It was about the same quality as the last episode, but I just can't find anything in this series to excite me at this point. And I hear it definitely gets much better immediately afterwards, so I'm still planning to read the manga, but it's not an exciting anime, and dear me, why did they use the Iron Man cut where you just fade to black to 2 seconds and then go to a different scene? That was a very visible moment of poor production values.
That's awful. I didn't even watch it this week. I think that, Clint, you and I have both just grown really, really disappointed with the adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, it's adapting what for me was a boring part of the manga, and it's doing it worse than the manga did.
Yeah.
So it's tough for me to reread the plot again.
I miss, even when the anime was at semi-interesting moments in the plot, I miss all the like pseudo ukiyo-e art. Like there is no way to properly convey the embellished art style at moments, like when Nura uses Kyoka Suigetsu or anything like that. It's just, there's none of the flair, and if for this arc, all of the boring.
Yeah.
It's too bad. Okay, next up is Legend of the Legendary Heroes, episode 17, Drew.
This way, we got a little bit of aftermath of Ferris and Reiner coming back to Roland, a little bit of investigation into, oddly enough, Ferris's past with her brother. And her brother is kind of a creeper, and frankly, so were her parents. There was an attempted rape scene in this episode from her flashback, and it was stopped by her brother, who, while he murdered his dad, chanted destruction rebirth. That said, that led to an interesting confrontation between himself and Reiner, who discovered that there is a curse on Ferris's brother as a result of that, and he can't leave Roland, which is why Reiner and Ferris are now setting out to be Sion's bodyguards as they go back to Estabel, which itself leads to a very interesting story arc. And that's basically where we are after this episode. After that and a couple of good scenes of just the characters chilling around.
Like that episode?
Yeah, it was a decent episode. Certainly the comedy between the characters has not gotten old, but gotten fresher.
Cool. All right, next up is Squid Girl, Shinryaku Ika Musume, episode 3.
So basically this episode, they're trying to teach Squid Girl about ghosts, and she's completely foreign to the concept, and they're trying to get her scared by ghosts. So they go to a cemetery and they're trying to scare her by taking her around where all these dead people are, and she's completely unimpressed. And she actually gets lost from the group, which is the time when she ignites her Firefly Squid ability and begins to glow as Firefly Squids do. And she actually convinces everyone else that she's a ghost by glowing, and they all run away, and she's lost in there without any idea to get home, and real ghosts guide her out of the forest back to the place, and she just thinks they're nice humans. And so that's that portion of the episode. The rest of the episode is the introduction of a new character working in the cafe, a surfer girl who is appropriately terrified of Squid Girl, and Squid Girl loves her for it. And then Squid Girl's phobia of killer whales and sharks, and their blow-up dolls.
Especially when they're inflated.
The inflated killer whales. she thinks she's being cornered by them, and like humans are training them to hunt squid or something.
All right. Next up on the list is Toaru Majutsu no Index 2, Episode 3.
So this episode was basically more elaboration on, like, everyone's looking for Ursula Aquinas. Well, she got kidnapped by the bad faction of the Amakusa Church. They go to the Amakusa Church. They save her. We get a couple more moments from our protagonist of him just being, like, the good guy of all good guys. And then we have the big flip twist at the ending is the Amakusa Church were actually just trying to stop the Roman Catholic Church from killing her. And at the end, it's kind of proven true. We see her get taken away by the Roman Catholic Church. We hear her scream. There are a couple members of the Roman Catholic Church fighting Toma, trying to stop him from going to retrieve her. And that's where we leave off.
Yeah, regarding specifically, before we get to that plot twist, specifically just the Toma being a generic hero, like, are you as tired of that as I am?
Well, it's kind of, it's Kamijo Toma. He is the good guy. He will do good for anyone, even if it is on, you know, it's a detriment to himself.
Well, I have no issue with the actual doing of good. It's like the, I'm telling you that I'm doing good, and I'm not going to let you do bad because I'll make sure that you do good. It's like, it's the long-winded speeches as hero protagonist.
Yeah, nothing has been as bad as the first episode. In this, in the most recent episode, he kind of had a short, like, moment of, like, if you're someone that fights for others' people, then put down your sword. I don't want to fight you.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, do you approve of that plot twist? The Amakusa were actually, I guess, quote unquote, good?
Yeah, the sort of good in a way. I mean, the guy from the Amakusa himself says, find Ursula Aquinas and take her where neither we nor the other, nor the Roman Catholic Church can get to her.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a pretty good plot twist. And I mean, the Roman Catholic Church, who we've seen Agnes from, and was kind of established as not an evil character by any means. Mm-hmm. She was fairly normal. But, like, the characters we see afterwards are definitely evil in their fight with Toma. And
it's Catholics.
Yep. It was a pretty good twist. It was a pretty good episode overall.
Cool. All right, Drew, World Golly Knows, Episode 3.
With this, we saw sort of the conclusion of the arc featuring the capture of Tsukushi Mio. She had went through the whole scene with Kama driving her carriage, sort of carrying her through rickshaws, and they got increasingly elaborate until he couldn't carry them anymore. And then he sort of started to become more significant to her, and then they went to a party, and they romanced, and he freed the soul.
What do you think of it?
It was better than the previous two. It still feels to me kind of a blah adaptation, just sort of there.
Mm-hmm.
Except for one moment, like earlier on in the episode, where Kama learned how to yodel. Or that's one way of putting it. Basically, he goes through one of those very elaborate fantasy sequences explaining Galge cliches to Elsie.
I thought that sequence was done pretty well, but I got to disagree with Drew here. I thought the actual meat of the episode where he was resolving the arc with Mio was excellently well done. There was a lot of emotion to the scene, and it was very well conveyed and pretty moving when talking about her father and not wanting to forget his memories and how she hadn't been burning incense because she was trying to kind of live the life that he wanted for her.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very good episode.
Great. Finally, Bakuman Episode 3. Largely, this deals with them arriving in Mashiro's uncle's studio, kind of just there's a lot of the episodes spent just kind of being manga nerds, looking around at all the cool stuff, the figurines, the manga itself, which if you are a knowledgeable manga fan, you can find some either cameos or art that is intended to look like a cameo, even if it's kind of deliberately being vague.
Kochikame volumes.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like Kochikame volumes to me. You see, as far as I'm concerned, it's Ryotsu and the trademark eyebrow. I mean, you can't really fake that. But yeah, a lot of homage paid, a lot of references to various Jump manga, Jack manga.
Shonen Jack.
Can't believe they don't get the rights to that name. It's ridiculous.
It's increasingly getting on my nerves. And every time I hear them say Jack, every time they meet with a publisher named from a company named Shonen Jack, it's really going to bother me.
Yeah. I don't even understand it. Like, why wouldn't they have the rights and then have the rights to mention series names? I actually legitimately don't understand it, not even in a critical fashion. I just don't get why that's the case. They find the box of letters that Mashiro's uncle had written to the girl that he pined for all of those years, which we had seen discussed in previous episodes. And then they come to find out that girl is actually Azuki's mother, and they go visit her and then talk to her about it. And basically, the consequence of all that she essentially asks, and they kind of immediately adhere to the idea of not revealing to Azuki that was the scenario. And I thought way back, I mean, obviously, Clint, you and I are both current on the manga, but this did refresh my memory. I thought that was a really interesting twist to have a character that, granted, it's not like this is a character we knew and loved, Azuki's mom, but of the available pool of characters, it wasn't just let's introduce someone else and let's introduce a whole bunch of new plot. I thought it was really nice to tie in a character that we sort of knew and then also make it really influential on the relationship between Mashiro and Azuki.
Yeah, that was pretty well done. I mean, they kind of set up a mirror of the relationships where, like, it's very similar, the relationship his uncle had with Azuki's mother and the relationship he has with Azuki.
Mm-hmm.
He's just trying to not make the same mistakes.
Right. It does, in a way, first of all, it's just an interesting plot device on its own. And then also, you can kind of see it as a story of redemption with him kind of redeeming everything. The ideal of the romanticism of the uncle, even if the execution was not great or just even circumstantially unfortunate, whichever way you choose to look at it. It's a nice way of addressing that situation. But I thought the issues raised in this episode were very good, and they really helped to drive the plot forward. All right, moving on. It is time for This Week in Manga, and we're going to begin with a monthly series, a freshly debuted monthly series in Jump Square called Dunten Prism Solar Car, which is it's jumped on the solar car bandwagon, guys.
Not another one.
I know.
Number 63?
Seriously, there's so many of these damn solar car series out there. Here's yet another one. Anyway, this is an interesting, unique series by the author of Moonlight Mile and the artist of Eye Shield 21, both of whom deserve recognition in their own regard. I would have to say I certainly am more immediately respectful of Yusuke Murata, the artist. His works amaze me, and I still have the infinite respect for him for drawing those Jump 40th anniversary posters that I absolutely adore. Our friends at CXC Scans have scanned the first chapter and hopefully everything onward of this series. We encourage you strongly to go read it at their site, CXC Scans. And I thought it was really a rather interesting idea. Basically, the main character, when he was young, he was in a car accident. His entire family was in the car. The father passed away in that accident. As a result of that, he has grown to hate cars, so he always bicycles around. He is a kind of a workaholic, and as such, he doesn't really have any friends because he's always working due to family-related circumstances. His father died. He kind of had to help pay for his own way. So he's working in a factory. He has a second job as a traffic guard. He's saving up to go to college, but he's a little bit jealous of the kids around him that he sees actually going to college at what you would consider the proper age. The local engineering school rents out the warehouse where he lives and or works. To help build to build this solar car that they want. Their dream is to enter this solar car into the most renowned solar car race, which you'll have to pardon me for forgetting the name of because it's a solar car race.
It really does exist, though.
Grand Prix. Yeah.
Oh no, I'm totally respectful of you know these new technologies and all that. It's just you have to pardon me that I'm not as familiar with them as I might be certain other aspects of the world.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, first of all, let's just touch on all that before we get to the end of the chapter. that's a lot of interesting information to pump into the first chapter of a monthly series. And I have to say, what I appreciated most, all the storyline elements aside, what I appreciated most about this first chapter is the way that narrative boxes, which are something I usually dislike strongly, I appreciate the way that narrative boxes were used to introduce this main character, because this is a monthly series. It will automatically suffer, unfortunately, from slow pacing. To kind of jump us right into the middle, into the action of this story, I find really, really highly appreciated. We get a little bit of information. This is the name of this main character. This is how old he is. This is what used to happen to him. This is who he is now. Okay, that's out of the way. Now we're into the story. I really liked that. But your thoughts, Drew, overall on just the entire setup of this entire story?
I think the setup was done very nicely. Yes, you can say it's sort of like, in some ways, a generic plot because it's a guy who hates cars because of his backstory and then has to help building a solar car, but you don't really get that sort of generic feel reading the chapter, and I think that's important, just the execution and how it's done. And it was definitely a very convincing, very good character-establishing chapter.
Right. I totally agree with you. It could be misconstrued as, character hates blank because blank happened to him. I mean, if you boil it down that much, absolutely, you'd be right to kind of be skeptical about something. But it's not like he's, like, going to set out to get revenge against cars. I mean, this is such a new territory that I think it'll work. What did you make of this chapter?
I thought it was really well done. I mean, it has there's a lot of potential for conflict between the characters, and there's definitely going to be some drama going on in the series to drive the plot of it.
Oh, yeah. Essentially, what happens in the tail end of this introductory chapter is that these engineering students come over, and our main character is so resentful of the life that they're able to lead. You know, they are fortunate enough to be able to go to college, to chase after their dreams while he's stuck working. So combine that with the fact that they're working on a car, then obviously it sets up the scenario that he is automatically a rival to them, kind of a foil to them. He doesn't want to, but he's being requested to help them, to teach them to do different engineering techniques that he works on a day-to-day basis, like welding and such. So I think that, the dynamic there, the very poor relationship to start with, but then the construction of those friendships and relationships, all while working on a car, which also should be interesting in its own right, it's all going to create a very fascinating scenario to me. Yes, it's a monthly series, so we have to wait a while, but I'm eagerly looking forward to chapter two.
Yeah, I've already just delved into this series and I was comfortable. I think definitely part of the reason was we already have the main character set up, and we'll just be seeing how they develop from here on out, how the group dynamics emerge.
Right. What do you think?
Yeah, it should be good from here on out. I mean, definitely seeing how he relates to the other students and what he comes to think of them and how they get closer together, because you would assume that they would.
Right. No, the whole series is just going to be him hating them. All right, I'll teach you to weld, but at a price. Okay, that takes care of the monthly series, singular, this week. Now it's time for the weekly series. We're going to start with Naruto, Chapter 514, and Subliminal Sexual Messages. That aside, it was called Kabuto's Plot was the chapter, and we left off last week. We thought we were going to get this fight between the Tsuchikage and Deidara, and we never really see that pan out. You kind of see them, like, charging up attacks, kind of dancing around one another to get an advantage in terms of location, flying around, but this fight never actually really happens.
I kind of hate that they keep showing the Tsuchikage pulling out this, for all intents and purposes, it looks like the beginning of a Hadouken. And they keep referring to, his dust attack, and, like, I need to watch out for his dust attack. And, like, if he used his dust attack right now, it would completely obliterate the turtle and everything around it. And then we never see it.
Yeah, that is actually really irritating, come to think of it.
Got far enough away, and that's it.
Dust attack forever. What we do get to see is Kabuto kind of separate himself from Deidara, fake or whatnot, Deidara flying around. Kabuto goes down, and his intent is to go after Naruto, and he's met with, first of all, Kurotsuchi, the granddaughter of the Tsuchikage, and she's kind of, first of all, keeping him at bay slash just going after him on the offensive. But soon she is joined by a lot of the people that were inside the turtle, Yamato, Aoba, Matoi, and this group attempts to fight because they've managed to convince Naruto that it was just an earthquake, because Naruto is a complete blithering idiot.
True to character.
True to character. Although I pointed out in the review on the website that I was a little bit disappointed that they really had to hammer it home. Like, oh, yeah, good thing he's so dumb. Like, can't you just show that to me? I get it already. I know the character.
We know that Naruto is not the brightest character in Naruto.
Stereotypical Naruto not figuring things out.
Yeah.
If it was Sasuke, he would have figured out a long time ago.
Oh man, if it was Sasuke,
he would have figured out and cut Kabuto in half and made a really gay pose while doing so.
If it was Sasuke, he would have been able to get the turtle to swim under the ocean and go down into the center of the earth. Sasuke can do anything, man. I hate Sasuke. But anyway, what actually happened in this chapter? So basically, Naruto being kind of safely confined in the turtle for now, Yamato, Aoba, Matoi, and now Kurosuchi, they're all fighting against Kabuto, who is even... we already knew that he took on a lot of characteristics of Orochimaru, but we've never seen them demonstrated to the extent that we have in this chapter. I mean, he's far more snake-like or just outright a snake than we expected. Are you okay with him taking so many elements from Orochimaru's character?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of cheapens him on one level, but we haven't seen him degenerating to, like, a personality of Madara yet, or Orochimaru yet, sorry.
Yeah.
So, at least there's still that. He still has his own being.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think he's still distinct enough, because it was sort of always part of his character that he really looked up to, respected Orochimaru, and certainly him taking the techniques is a part of that. I think he's definitely done enough in this chapter specifically to stand up in his own.
With regard to what he did in this chapter that made him stand out, the thing that I always appreciated about him was the kind of like behind the scenes manipulation that he always showed hints of, the decision making. And certainly that's demonstrated when he decides, where he later concretely explains his thought process. He realizes that trying to go after and capture Naruto and maybe B as well, we don't know, is a completely losing proposition. He doesn't stand a chance. So instead, he decides to capture Yamato, both because of the information that he would have, having been a bodyguard of Naruto for so long now, and also apparently specifically to be able to create more Zetsu clones. And that part is interesting, and you had a theory as to exactly how that would play into that part of the plot.
Yeah, Yamato is a wood element user based on him receiving some DNA from the first Hokage in one of Orochimaru's experiments. And we know that the first Hokage, a fake body husk of him created from his DNA, is in use in some fashion within Madara's cave. So it stands to reason that it takes a wood element user to produce more Zetsu clones, and that's what they're going to be using him for.
Right. Yeah, that would be very interesting. And if that is the reasoning behind it, that shows that Kabuto not only made the right decision, as we've seen already, but he made the right decision based on knowledge that he probably shouldn't even have had. So it's both that he has excellent decision-making and that he's even further connected than we might have expected.
Yeah, I mean, we've been getting hints of that all along. Madara saying, how do you know this? You're not supposed to know about any of this.
Right.
For a while now.
I mean, he makes an interesting proposition for, like, a final boss. If we're talking about Madara hasn't been that satisfying of a villain overall.
Right.
Like, him backstabbing Madara, I'd be totally fine with at this point.
I would adore it. I think that his decision overall, all the further explanation and later explanation aside, I think just the initial decision to capture Yamato is a brilliant one.
Yeah, I think it certainly adds a lot to the story instead of, like, because it would have cheapened Naruto to all heck to have him lose this soon after a huge power-up.
Yeah, that, or certainly he couldn't beat Kabuto at this point, or if the fight was interrupted, then it would have just felt like all of the time spent developing that part of the story would have been wasted. I mean, this is really the absolute best scenario that I can think of. I'm very thoroughly pleased with the direction this has taken, and I'm also pleased that, I mean, you may have heard last week I was saying I really don't look forward to this Deidara fight. It didn't even happen. Yeah, there was a little bit of Deidara action in the sense of him like, oh, I'll blow him up with C4, internal monologue. But he didn't actually do anything. Regarding that, I want to clarify something, or at least attempt to clarify something. I thought that Deidara was a Zetsu clone, but he is summoned away, or I guess recalled, maybe, by Kabuto. I didn't really attach those two or associate those two abilities together.
We do see Kabuto much earlier on summon three coffins.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them, four coffins, three of them which we saw, and then one of them which we kind of... It was the one that Madara was like, oh, I guess I'm going to have to let you join me.
Right.
But the three coffins he summoned, there's no indication that those weren't the dead bodies of Akatsuki members.
Right. Yeah. So basically what I was wondering is that Deidara actually the real dead Deidara, or if it's a Zetsu clone? Because the part that really thoroughly confused me is that when Kabuto was about to leave Madara's side, when he offered to go off on this little mission for him to show his loyalty, he basically said, yeah, I'll go. I just need to borrow one of your Zetsus. So it stood to reason that the Deidara he had was like a shape-shifted Zetsu, something like that. Who knows exactly what Zetsu is. If it if it's just a body, okay, I understand that he can summon him, recall him, whatever. But if it's a Zetsu clone and he can summon those at will, does he not suddenly become infinitely more powerful?
Yeah, I mean, like, with the 100,000 that are there, that's sort of incredibly difficult to say. Just, can he summon all of them? If so, that's going to be a huge tactical asset if a large-scale war breaks out.
Yeah. If you, the listener, have any information on that at all, you know, I could have just missed a piece of information that would very well be likely to happen. If you know what all that is about, please email in shonenbeam@gmail.com. Now, though, it's time for One Piece, Chapter 601. We have a couple little tidbits at the beginning. We see Brook focused. He's finally on his way back. He has a friend of Shaki. He's riding on an air bike to get back to the Grove 42 where they're all meeting up finally. We see Sanji talking down to Zoro, hilariously speaking in like little broken up sentences, defining just like key words as though he's like a little kid. I found that brilliantly funny.
Yeah, the whole interplay, like Zoro calling him number 7 and then in this chapter, Sanji coming back and speaking to Zoro like that, like they've done really well on their relationship between each other after the time skip.
Yeah, I love that
hasn't changed, and it's still satisfying comedy.
Fake Luffy, surprisingly, doesn't have any command over these very, very high bounty pirates that he's assembled as potentially real Luffy. So we see the Karibu-Koribu pair kind of starting to run amok, especially the wilder one. He shoots down a marine. First of all, just a tiny little note. Do you think that counts as a confirmed death?
I would say, I guess, it's shown sort of off-screen. We don't really see the body, but still, it looks like he killed someone.
I think this is kind of as close as we get to, like, a confirmed death in, like, such a prominent shonen series that we know so many little kids read.
Yeah. That's just that doesn't really matter. I was just curious because that's always been a big issue.
At least for confirmed minor character death, anyway.
Right, kind of the same thing as like Mr. 13, perhaps. Here come the pacifistas to kind of break up this entire party, and they take out Captain Doty right away. Darn, I had high hopes for him.
Yeah, played a little too much lip service, a little too much lip action.
And basically, they just kind of terrorize everyone, and it becomes obvious, and it is revealed that fake Luffy is not, in fact, Luffy whatsoever. He's just some, like, what was it, like 27 million?
22 million, something?
Black, or three-tongued Amalo Black.
Yeah. I appreciate that Oda didn't forget to give us a name and, like, really ridiculously, stupidly low bounty for this loser.
Yeah,
hey, it was higher than Buggy's was.
Buggy's was, yeah. I hope that's changed. Better have. But yeah, Sentomaru comes in with the pacifistas and basically just makes it quite obvious. You know, you're not Luffy. Luffy wasn't some little piece of shit like you are. But in all of this chaos, the cloak gets blown off of Luffy, and the real Luffy, who had been there this whole time, is unveiled. And he doesn't really start to run amok necessarily, but he is targeted and attacked, and he manages to, first of all, dodge one of the pacifistas' lasers in a very passive and suave sort of way that I've really dreaded would happen. This is a one-off instance so far. Who's to say that he'll ever do this again? But just on the evidence that we've been presented, I am really skeptical about this. This is exactly what I don't want to happen to Luffy, for him to be all cool and calm and collected. Did you take anything away from that? Is it just a one-off, or do you look into that a little bit more?
I didn't really look into it too much. I mean, it's just a demonstration. He's really trying to push home the fact that he has haki now, and he's kind of in a different class than he was before. He's just trying to show I feel like Oda's trying to show the effects of the time skip.
Yeah, I feel like it was more just like showing off the character. I don't feel like it's going to become a permanent trait yet. Certainly he showed enough after that it didn't seem to be a habit.
Right. And after that, he goes into Gear Second. First of all, kind of maybe it was an artistic license to kind of speed up the, I guess, transformation scene. It's not really a transformation scene, but you don't really see him do the whole, like, pumping the legs. He just kind of instantly goes into it. I wonder if the preparation is going to be ignored from now on, but that's just an aside. He goes into Gear Second. He uses Jet Pistol to take out the pacifista himself. He spots Sanji and Zoro, who are there as well, and the two of them combine to take out a pacifista. And I want to ask you, as I presented on the website, the way that I read that, Luffy had to use Gear Second still. Sanji, to me, looked like quietly he had kind of gone into Diable Jump, because there is at least a trail of smoke coming from his leg. And the tip of his leg, which is usually kind of burning when Diable Jump is activated, it was drawn in sort of the same way, as kind of like it wasn't colored in all the way. So whether or not he was in Diable Jambe, Zoro at least definitely had not used some kind of a named attack. That was just a sword slash. So my question that I raised on the site was, if Luffy used Gear Second, if Sanji used Diable Jambe, does that mean that Zoro has then come further from where they were? Not to say he's like stronger than Luffy, obviously, but in terms of who's made the most progress, could he be further ahead than the other two? Did you read anything at all into that entire display of power?
He might have come farther. I did notice immediately with Luffy that he had powered up to Gear Second and used Jet Pistol, which was kind of, it was jarring to me because I would have thought, you know, this soon after the power up, you would do something in normal form to show how much stronger he's gotten.
Right. Yeah, that is a bit of a surprise, actually. But is it a bad surprise? Because we all said before the time skip, we don't want them to change tremendous amounts. We don't want them to be broken, super powerful Dragon Ball Z-like characters. Do you mind that he went to Gear Second?
No, it doesn't really bother me. It's just kind of there.
Okay. Oh, did you make anything out of all this?
Well, to me, like, the one thing I did not like about this chapter was this specifically, because it kind of looked like they were just using the same techniques they had used several years ago against an improved model of Pacifista and just beating it down this time, which to me, it felt kind of insignificant for them to, yes, they're more powerful than it now, but it doesn't really feel like I've been shown it. Just, they beat it. Okay.
Yeah, I have really clear mixed feelings, which again, I did raise in the review on the site. But I mean, on one hand, I totally echo your sentiment where right now it does sort of just feel like a linear power up. And and that's not in the One Piece tradition. One Piece should be more creative than that by design. But on the other hand, you do have to say, I mean, if they weren't able to dispose of a Pacifista this handily, I mean, that was the measure of what defeated them. Yeah, there were others, you know, Kizaru, Sentomura, etc. But that was kind of the big focus right before the time skip, is that they couldn't do anything against the Pacifistas and Kuma. If they weren't able to kind of handily destroy them after this big, elaborate, drawn-out time skip and power-up, then what was the point of the time skip?
Oh, they had to be able to take out the Pacifistas. What I sort of object to is the way in which they just sort of did it with the same techniques they did beforehand. Doesn't really feel like they learned anything at this point.
Would you have appreciated them doing it kind of as Clint suggested would have seemed more normal, just doing it in like totally normal form? Or would you perhaps have preferred them showing some kind of creative, outlandish new thing that they've learned?
Well, I would prefer like maybe a little bit of show off of technique. Maybe definitely not the full extent of it, but just like a little instance or like indication that they had learned something new would have been really nice.
Kind of in the same vein as what Usopp did in the bar with like the hint of the
pop
green.
Yeah, like the pop greens.
Okay, yeah, that would have worked better, I think. And I do find it, I mean, once again, as with Naruto, I would love to get listener input on what you made of that scene with Sanji, because we couldn't come to an agreement in here as to whether he was using Diable Jambe or not. But if you have thoughts on that, again, shonenbeam@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. The chapter ends, I mean, that's the bulk of the chapter. The chapter actually does end with Luffy calling out to Rayleigh, much to the chagrin of everyone. I do love the reaction shots from all the, like, the nobodies who were there. Like, oh my god, that's the real Luffy. Oh my god, the Dark King is here. That was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, Luffy calls out to Rayleigh, and basically, the chapter, it was longer than this, but basically the chapter was kind of a new Romance Dawn. It was kind of the first chapter of the new series, basically. Luffy calls out to him and says, you know, thanks very much for everything. I'm going to become the Pirate King. Are we finally moving forward, reunion onward next chapter, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, there is no reason why they can't have the reunion next chapter other than poor pacing.
I think we really need to at this point. Like, it has to be like the next chapter. I said that before chapter 600, yeah. But I'm going to say it again. We really have to.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with both of you. Okay, once again, there is no Bleach this week. It'll be back next week, and I think Naruto will be off, so we'll be back with a different Big Two next week. But now it's time for Bakuman, Chapter 106, Shiratorimon. All right, so where we last left off, it's Shiratori's mom being the kind of raving bitch that she's being painted out as being here. She's just coming in and completely criticizing all these mangaka for what they do as a living and as a passion. And we specifically left off with Takagi declaring that he was going to do Robita in peace, something that the Shiratori family would be proud of. Which, once again, we've illustrated that we really don't appreciate the focus on using our main characters as a vehicle for a very minor character is really frustrating. We have more of that here, where basically everyone is just challenging Shiratori's mother, including the rest of the family, the father who kind of chimes in and said, oh, have you even read his manga? It's really good.
Yeah, on an off note, last time you mentioned that the father was kind of set up, it was kind of like sexist to set up the father as this kind of good guy and the mother is this horrible bitch. I kind of think the father isn't being portrayed very well either. He's just this spineless person who won't speak up and like tell the mother, hey, why don't you stop being such a bitch?
You don't think that would have come off as more sexist?
I think having him being strong would have been a testament to his character. Right now, they're both kind of just weak characters.
I could still argue for at least a hint of sexism just in the way the mother's being portrayed, because you wouldn't have to compare that to the father necessarily. Just painting a woman as pure evil with absolutely no other recourse, right? With no other hint of her personality, that to me you could call that a little bit of sexism, because there's so few important female characters in the series, and like, again, as with Mashiro's mom, as we just saw recently in the anime, some of them are, many of them, come to think of it, are at least initially portrayed as evil, mean spirited, what have you. But yeah, you are right that his father is kind of a wuss. Totally, he's totally spineless and doesn't contribute anything. The one thing that I did take away from this whole family coming in and Shiratori scenario is the sister, actually, and the preachy assistant, the way that he's all of a sudden completely fallen for her in like that one panel.
Yeah, that
I
was
found that very funny.
That was pretty funny that he was just like all wanting to be with her, and now he's in love with her. And
That's kind of the recurring problem in all of this, is that the other minor characters are still thoroughly enjoyable. It's only because, frankly, Shiratori was fine until he got so much focus, too. It's just that he's gotten all this focus.
Yeah, until Shiratori got a huge amount of just time devoted to him and pages devoted to him, he was fine.
Yeah, so we see other supporting characters in this, like Hiramaru, which sets up one of the best moments of the entire chapter. Well, essentially, he receives the news that Otter 11 is canceled, or is set to be canceled, I think 6 weeks from this point.
Yeah.
And he gives, I've read a lot of Takeshi Obata work. This is my absolute best, favorite piece of art in all of his works. The expression on the face of Hiramaru when he hears that he's been canceled.
Yeah, a stark panel of awesome.
I'm loading it up again just to look at it again. It doesn't look like it's from this. It looks like it's from Level E, actually, which we talked about recently. It looks like out of that Alien manga by Togashi. I love that panel. He is not the only one to be canceled or ending soon. Also,
Alkiko's Time of Green Leaves.
Right. So obviously the two of them being canceled at the same time gives the opportunity for a little bit of a consolation meeting or what have you. Part of that is because they introduce this concept. They're kind of mirroring the real life Jump Super Legends one-shot idea, where they're going to be running 5 or 6 consecutive weeks of one-shots by noted authors. And so basically these characters who are just being canceled are being encouraged to apply for that.
Now, the fact that they're doing this is kind of like starting me to like, who are the mirrors of these authors in real life?
That is interesting.
Hiramaru is Sorachi.
Probably. I mean, if anybody, yeah, I mean, the Otter 11, if any real life author, it'd be him or it'd be Usta Kiyosuke of Jaguar. I'd have to say it would be Otter. But anyway, that's a long discussion for another time. So basically, the person responsible for the concept of weekly Aokiko, Hiramaru's editor, sets up a phone call to try to motivate him, because he's realizing he has no way to motivate this kid because he never wants to.
Hiramaru's immediate response to being canceled was, great, now I can do nothing for 2 or 3 years off of the money I've earned.
And then go get a rich job. So yeah. He doesn't even want to do manga anymore. And so as a result of that, he sets up a phone call where he encourages Hiramaru to call Aoki to kind of set up a, you know, let's encourage each other, where we've both come on hard times, you know, everything's going to be okay, let's do our best in the one-shots. And she's so receptive that she sets up a little tea date, much to the surprise of the editor.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, it went so well that we got a tea date. Like, what? Oh, I mean, all according to plan, of course.
Yeah.
That was a very funny moment. I love all the comedy surrounding Aokiko and Hiramaru and this editor.
How funny would it be if they hooked up?
Well, it's kind of setting you up to think that they will just like the defy all odds for comedic purposes do that. And who else is really interested in Aoki, really?
Besides the creepy artist.
Well,
guy
besides
who's
the
gone.
Yeah, Nakai, I mean, but that's kind of gone.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to see Hiramaru fight him for her honor. yeah, so there's that. Basically, that is most of the entire chapter. The last little bit at the end is kind of looking once again at Mashiro and this entire concept of him drawing, inking from outlines. And basically, for the most part, we're shown an example of the two art styles back to back. And for the most part, the one that he inks just from the outline, it is made to look worse. But Takagi points out that the hair actually looks a little bit better in that one than in the fully detailed one. It looks a little bit more natural, a little less intense.
Yeah.
And I really do appreciate that. That seems the direction that it's going to go, perhaps leading Mashiro to be a little bit more free-flowing, fluid in his art style. And that's something, I'm not a visual artist whatsoever. That's something that's simple enough and yet a little advanced enough to be accessible, but... interesting to me.
Yeah, for me, it was impressive to see both versions of the drawing in this, because as someone who's like drawn a little bit before, as anyone who's drawn before can attest to, drawing in like two separate styles is very challenging.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Like making them look absolutely different, like making them look as though it's something that has actually progressed within your style is really challenging.
The only other point of note in this chapter is the concept of who's going to do what in the one shot. You get to see a little glimpse of everyone wanting to be in this one shot. Of course, Eiji wants to do a one shot because he's Eiji.
Eiji can do everything.
but there's a lot of setup being hinted at Iwase and Mashiro coming together to work together to do a one shot. And then you also get the feeling like it's not just going to be straightforward, because initially Ashirogi Muto are going to enter as a tandem, but you get the idea that the way that it's illustrated and introduced to you is that it's just not going to work. The Takagi is going to be too busy with the two series. So it's kind of the best of no worlds, really, because you get the idea that Masho is going to split off from Ashirogi and work with Iwase, which is kind of a betrayal of what we want. And yet it's not even going to happen immediately. We have to sit through a lot of drama to get to that point. That would be really frustrating.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that there's no real way it can go forward well from here. Either we're going to go through a lot of plot and drama to get to a point that we knew was coming where mm-hmm. Mashiro teams up with Iwase, or we don't have Mashiro team up with Iwase, in which case, what was all of this foreshadowing? What was with the pacing pages of Iwase while Mashiro was saying that he wants to draw?
Yeah, it could be interesting if we get to that point really, really fast, but otherwise, I really hope that we go in another direction.
Yeah.
All right, now it's time for Beelzebub, Chapter 81, Wet Nurses, and more Wet Nurses, and some other Wet Nurses.
Yeah, all wearing some sort of cut dress,
yeah.
Weirdly enough.
Actually, the most important couple parts of this chapter have nothing really to do with the Wet Nurses, rather who they serve, actually. First of all, we get to meet N, Baby Beel's older brother, which is... Just the thought of introducing another character in the royal family related to BBBL, what do you make of just that decision?
I don't mind, like, seeing other members of the royal family, certainly. The same arbitrary, like, craziness that BBBL has. They can't be babies, but they can still be pretty odd and cool in their own way.
And certainly N is odd. We can each comment on whether we think he's cool, but he's definitely odd. Basically, he asks one of his wet nurses to summon up a chair, and then he kind of has like one of them fanning him, one of them getting his preferred drink, which is Sprite on ice.
Sprite on ice.
Well, that was kind of funny. And basically, he's not here to like fight or do anything menacing necessarily. He's here to deliver a message, but we can't talk about that right away. We need to get a little bit of a change of scenery. So they go to Furuichi's house, which, yeah, why do they go to Furuichi's house? Much to his dismay. just that moment, that the deadpan shot of... it's like, I want to go somewhere to eat potato chips. Oga's just like, yeah, okay. He goes along with it. And then the very next page, they're all in Furuichi's house. I loved that comedic setup.
Yeah, that was just, of course they have to go to Furuichi's house because as Oga says, it wouldn't be funny if my house got destroyed.
Not at all.
Yeah, that was great. But then the main piece of information to be taken away from this is that N is here to deliver the message that, his father, the great demon king, has decided, well, you know what? That baby Beel's going to take way too long to destroy the Earth. I'm going to destroy the Earth tomorrow. That's kind of an important thing.
That's a little bit. He just found humanity annoying, which, you know, I can sympathize with.
Yeah.
But tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Good luck having an all-nighter training session.
Yeah. So this is, some people have kind of said this is kind of like Chapter 1 Redux, which in a way you can kind of see that. But certainly we would lose out on a lot of the... the important character development to this point. The characters mean a lot more to us now. But what do you make of this scenario? Now we've kind of forgotten about the entire concept of Baby BL growing to the point where he can take care of humanity all by himself. That was just kind of like, oh, that's the initial comedic setup. Ha ha. Now here's a bunch of adventure and comedy. Now this is obviously very pressing. This is the main plot right now. What do you make of that switch?
Well, I think this chapter was handled a bit better than previous ones, and as far as encouraging me towards the demon arc, it's just sort of a comedic twist towards something that is kind of serious, but obviously going to be dealt with as comedy. I liked it.
And what did you think of it, Clint?
Yeah, I think it's a good setup. I mean, more content with the demon world. I got to say, what I really picked out of this chapter, oddly enough, was a bit of owie that we got right at the beginning.
Ooh, yeah.
There was some great comedy when she was like, wait, what's going on? And he was like, Biel's a demon. Why aren't you getting this?
Didn't I tell you this already?
Everyone was like deadpan staring at her. That was great.
That might have been actually, come to think of it, that may have been the funniest part of the entire chapter. As much as I loved the pan over to Furuichi's house, just the, oh yeah, it must have been magic. Magic? Oh yeah, this kid's a demon. There's a lot of demons around here. Didn't you know that? Didn't I tell you? Complete deadpan shock.
Yeah. That was pretty good.
And then like the fact that she got knocked out and Oga was obviously really concerned for her.
It was nice, and it wasn't, I also appreciate the fact that it wasn't done like a sappy, like, either like, I have to protect my friends, or I have like vested romantic interest in her. It was more in like a, that was the wrong thing that you did. I have to be protectorate of my surroundings, my natural habitat, but it wasn't over the top. It wasn't like a shonen hero.
It
I have
was
to step
like
in
going
and save
up
the day.
To the roof earlier in the series.
Yeah, it was him performing the role that he feels is bestowed upon him.
Right.
And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I thought this was a very good setup chapter. I am really taken aback by the shock of it tomorrow. That's just really weird, but tomorrow. It's funny. It was funny.
Maybe his flight gets delayed or something.
Who knows at this point? If something this random can happen in one chapter, who knows what's coming next? But I'm looking forward to
it. And is actually a really fun character so far.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm enjoying him so far. One tiny last note that I brought up on the site. The idea of summoning. One of N's wet nurses summons up this chair, and that could be totally some little innocuous throwaway thing. But the way that I read into that is that Hilda is going to have to do some kind of power up. She's gotten trashed right here in the last few chapters. She got taken out by Zenjiro. She's been humiliated by Yolda and the other wet nurses. So right now she's been really humiliated. She's obviously going to have to train in some capacity. She doesn't really deserve to be like the frontline visible fighter. That's kind of Oga's job. She shouldn't be like way in the background. That's where Furuichi's supposed to be kind of making jokes. What if she were to gain some kind of summoning ability like Isabella was shown to use? Do you think that would kind of help her seamlessly fit into the group at that point?
I mean, first and foremost, I think her power-ups need to center around being a wet nurse for Baby BL. So if they made all of her like... all of her supposed power-ups in the series, things to, like, assist taking care of a demon baby, that would be great.
That would be cool.
That would be interesting, sort of like how Toriko power-ups all center around food.
Yeah. Would you be okay with the idea of summons?
I'd be cool with that, yeah.
All right, nice. Let's move on. Fairy Tail, Chapter 206, where Shanks goes Super Saiyan 3 to take out Luffy with Haki.
It looked more like Super Saiyan 2, but yeah.
Oh, that's a good
point.
It was
kind of like that. He just sort of went extremely powerful, got Natsu to admit defeat, and because of that, Natsu won.
Yeah. Frankly, I do have to say, I mean, joking comparisons aside, I do actually like Gildarts a lot as a character. I think he's a very strong character, but his strength has been shown in an interesting way. It wasn't just blatant display of power. I loved the little, like, cushioning his own impact, like, all the different methods of power that he's used so far. I really loved those.
He's pretty clever. I like the aspect in this chapter where they sort of... he wasn't moving from all of Natsu's attacks, but they only just sort of showed it very briefly here.
Yeah.
Instead of just drawing attention to, oh, I'm not going to move because you're 100 years too early to fight me.
Yeah.
It was just like him doing that and then Natsu forced him out of it, and that was interesting.
It's interesting that we're complimenting Fairy Tail on not being derivative.
Yeah. Odd that.
While a character that looks like Shanks fights.
Well, yes. I mean, okay, you have to give credit to that one. That one just, you saw them. You don't read Fairy Tail. You saw them. They look like Shanks and Luffy.
It's Shanks, yeah.
Yeah. The entire scene with Natsu kind of just being brought to his knees, whether it's a technique or just the realization of the gap in power, quietly slumping down to his knees, admitting defeat, and then the entire scene that follows with Gildart's kind of saying, you know, kind of reassuring him in a way, saying there are things he needs to do, but he's not all that far behind. I appreciated the relationship. I appreciated the admittance of defeat. I thought it wasn't like a particularly touching emotional scene, but I thought it was well handled for what needed to be achieved.
Yeah, I think it was at least a good scene. I kind of don't like how Natsu admitted defeat and then was allowed to win. I think it makes sense as a lesson he needs to learn, but why can't he just lose and then go back to the drawing board? Of course, that would have made sense in the flow of this chapter, but not in the overall story.
Yeah, that would
have just sort of left me with an odd dual impression.
That would have led to obviously Natsu can't lose right now. So then that would have led to the idea of, well, you can still lose in this first round and continue on, and that's just bizarre.
Yeah, that does feel a little bit weak.
Yeah.
But
Fairy Tail fans, great news. We have 3 chapters of Fairy Tail in next week's issue of Shonen Magazine. 3 chapters.
Not like a triple chapter, but like in separate parts.
3 actual chapters. And we do know the title of the first one, at least, from the preview. And the title is simply Messed. That character that we know practically nothing about. Are we due for some kind of huge revelation, some kind of gigantic significance to the plot, do you think?
I'm totally up for that. Mest certainly has been built up enough for his character to be shown at this point.
Right. There is obviously some tie-in. There's supposed to be some kind of a very big anime-related announcement for Fairy Tail, so that could be part of the occasion, but you wouldn't do 3 chapters.
Didn't they already announce a second season?
Yes, they did, so that's why I'm kind of wondering. Yeah,
let me get this straight.
Is it a movie or something, maybe?
We get 3 chapters of Fairy Tail and Bleach coming back from hiatus in 1 week.
Oh my goodness. And Naruto's going to be gone.
Naruto's gone.
This is going to be the best week ever. I'll tell you what, if all that happens and One Piece, the crew doesn't reunite, I'm done. I give up manga.
SWAT. Was there a SWAT double chapter or did I miss that?
Yeah, the SWAT anime will be announced too.
Get the party hats.
Okay, yeah. So overall, interesting Fairy Tail chapter. I can respect the fact that you don't like the methodology of having Natsu win by losing, but we do need to move on from this point. I do also appreciate the fact that we didn't spend too much time either in like the million mini Natsus. That could have been way too over the top.
Yeah, that was just short enough to be like a funny little tiny 2-page moment.
And I also appreciate the fact that we didn't spend too long in the fight overall. I felt it was well-paced.
I think this arc's been well-paced so far.
Yep.
And it has had entirely the right amount of cats, namely like 1 panel.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Majima. All right, Hayate no Gotoku, chapter 293. What happened in this one, Clint?
So basically in this chapter, we see Nagi and Chihiro arrive and they're selling manga from the stand. And then we kind of cut over and Hayate is being put into cross-dressing. He's in his maid outfit and his skirt is being flipped.
Why? Kotetsu.
So then we move to Luca, who we had Mario was asking me about before the show.
Mm-hmm.
Her name, we believe it's Luca.
This is the Hayate girl?
The Hayate girl.
The one that is exactly like Hayate, but a girl.
Yeah.
So Hayate... cross-dressing.
so it's Hayate cross-dressing, but actually a girl.
Yeah. No, okay. So we're going to attach the name Luca to this girl because we believe that is the right character name.
Yeah. She suits up in like a dog mascot suit, and she goes into the convention. We come back to Nagi selling manga, and someone very unpleasant has come up from like a popular circle and is down-talking this manga that her and Chihiro are selling from this the dolphin something circle.
Right.
And we cut to Luca standing off to the side in the mascot costume, looking kind of downcast. And then at the very end, we see that Hosen is there, and she's above the cosplay stage where Hayate in drag has been brought to.
So that sets up a bunch of little interesting mini scenarios, like Hayate being attacked while in drag.
Yeah.
That would be pretty funny to have to see. Because anytime Hayate's in drag, he's not just in drag. He's very much in character. Oh, I've fallen. Yeah, you know, the little, like, pretty boy scenes.
Yeah.
Or pretty girl scenes,
Hayate
even.
The combat maid.
It's not so much combat at that point. Hayate the fawning maid. Also, yeah, this Luca, apparently, this character, is she dolphin, do you think?
She's got to be. She's got to be, like, I mean, we've seen slight flashbacks to like Chihiro meeting with this, the author of the Dolphin Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Chihiro's like established friends with whoever the writer is. And then we see that Luca is now like invested in the, like the sales of the Dolphin manga.
Right. Yeah. It's almost too obvious to be true, but this isn't the kind of series that likes to pull swerves like that. So it's pretty apparent that she's going to be the behind Dolphin.
Yeah. Which means, she is really interesting because her manga, hold it, is on the level of Nagi's.
Yeah. That brings back a discussion that we had a little while ago when the very serious scene went down in Ashibashi Sensei's place where Nagi realized, you know, what am I doing? These are just like little scribbles. I'm worth nothing. I'll never be a mangaka. And we loved that, but there was a tiny negative to be taken away, which was the fact that if we just kept with that and moved away and she grew up from that phase, then we would never have those Nagi manga gags anymore, which were hilarious. This could kind of be a route back to that.
Yeah, if she sees someone else doing the same sort of thing and succeeding ostensibly at it, then there's no reason for her to not continue.
Yeah, I thought little interesting scenarios being set up here. I really liked this chapter. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
Excellent. Kakashi, chapter 326, Drew.
Well, this was very much a Tokine chapter, continuing from last one. She sort of dives towards the center of Mahoro's domain, eventually reaches there, wakes him up in a kind of rude manner by stabbing the ball he's sleeping in with a bunch of spear kekai, and then immediately afterwards, he asks her what she's doing, she opens negotiations, and he stabs her through the chest with a big black spear thing.
I hate being woken up like that. It's the worst.
It's kind of bad, yeah. You weren't like some immortal dimension master, maybe.
I just through that point in the chapter, I really appreciated Tokine's resolve. Really, the not that kind of resolve, the other kind of resolve.
It wasn't being reversed.
Yeah, no, the good kind of ethereal resolve,
conviction.
Exactly. I really appreciated her demeanor and her attitude, her professionalism, because this is such a fantastical scenario. She's venturing into a new world. I mean, you know, we could very easily get lost in all kinds of fantasy style talk. And she's bringing like legitimate, like political hard nosed debate style elements into this.
Tokine has always been the cool-headed character, and she's really showing it off here.
Oh yeah, this is fantastic. This was a wonderful chapter for just even all of the other stuff aside, the being stabbed, the way that she woke him up, all just the way that she composes herself. Just looking at her as a character, I loved this chapter on that facet alone. But that's not where the chapter ends.
That is not where the chapter ends. After she gets stabbed, we cut away to Shichiro, and he has a little conversation with Yoshimori's mom to the effect of, well, I'd like your help, but I don't really need it because Karasumori's going to get sealed either way. And he's just sort of, he's wondering about her. He asks her a question and we get cut off we see her answer to the question and then we sort of get cut off. And we go back to Tokine and she has been stabbed. She's got a stake through her body and then she just phases out of it. Apparently the new technique she's learned while she's been in training is she's intangible.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. I mean, whether you're looking at that from the standpoint of our tier list, whether you're looking at that at just in-universe, just at, for storyline purposes, she's been kind of inferior, kind of second banana to Yoshimori for some time now. This does a lot more than put her back in the mix.
Yeah, this does a bit more than that. I mean, it might not be a situational counter to Nichinaga, but in terms of fighting demons, like if there aren't specific time limits on this power, she's sort of become impervious and needs protection a lot less than she has at any previous point.
Now, let me ask you, do you like that? Because there was something that we discussed earlier when Tokine was reintroduced and we found out what it is that she was set to do, which was to go to this exact meeting. Something that we talked about, at least I know I did, was that, you know, Yoshimura has been built up as kind of the frontline fighter. I mean, it's a lot more complex than that, I give him credit, but basically to boil it down way too simply, he is kind of the frontline fighter, whereas Tokine was kind of the behind-the-scenes diplomat, and we really appreciated that. If she's given this power, I mean, I'm not saying that Yella Tanabe is going to miswrite the character and then have her go off and killing everybody. But if she's given this power, is that a little bit demeaning to the character that she's been built up as?
I really do not see that way. I think that the fact that she has this power, it's useful for negotiation, but there are still things that Yoshimori can do that she can't.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a strong, independent female character written in a way I've seen few others done.
Right.
So I really appreciate her not... not having an overpowered power necessarily, but having this very strong power that very well suits what she does.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. I was posing that question to you, sort of playing devil's advocate, because I believe that it's going to be handled very well, and I don't think that it will overpower her. I really like this this touch. One final brief note. My favorite, I can't really pick favorites in this series, but easily in the top few. I love Yoshimori's mom in all of this. She's just the most fascinating character to me, maybe in the entire series.
She definitely came up off as powerful this chapter, sort of just talking down to Shichiro, who we've already been established as powerful.
Yeah. We've already mentioned we're definitely in the final stretch of this manga, not to say like 10 chapters from now, but we're in the closing stretches.
The final battle exactly. Is coming up.
Do you think that we're ever going to get to see her do anything befitting of how much she's been built up?
I think we've got to see at least a little bit insofar as her being dominant, because we've flat out had it established she's more powerful than the main character, always has been, still is.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably the most important. She met with the Lord first of all,
right.
And just lots of other things about her, like this conversation indicating that she's just so talented, so much of a genius that she's never even had to wonder about any decisions she's made. So I feel like I would be cheated if I didn't see at least some of her doing something.
Exactly, as would I. And I have to ask also, I mean, this series has done a really good job of breaking exact conventions. I mean, there are some stereotypes that fit the mold here and there, but for the most part, it's escaped those fairly well. So I would definitely not say at all that she's a mentor character, but usually, I mean, this kind of a powerful character is usually set up to go in something. I mean, to transpose Kakashi's scenario to other worse manga, basically it would go down like they're doing everything they think that they have to do right. You know, Tokina convinces Mahara to do whatever. Whatever it is that she wants, and Yoshimori is all set in place, and then something goes wrong, and Yoshimori's mom has to come in and kind of save the day and lose her life in doing so. Obviously, that is not at all my prediction for this series, but do you feel that she's set up for some kind of a role specifically in relation to the entire final battle, or do you think she's just kind of going to completely escape the entire idea of a mentor character and just kind of be on the periphery the entire time?
I mean, I think we may see her a lot on the periphery. I think any direct confrontation that comes to her is going to be a significant one. I feel like we're going to see her in a battle of some sort at least once.
Okay, and it is unfair of me really to ask you questions about this character that, I mean, yeah, it's one thing for me to not know too much about her, but even you as a hardcore fan, I mean, we just don't know anything about her.
We haven't shown other than that she is powerful and that she's sort of abandoned her family but is still supporting them from the shadows.
Right. Yeah, but overall, I mean, I really, really enjoyed this chapter.
I was ecstatic at this chapter.
Okay, that was a lot of Kakashi for once. Good. Kenichi, chapters 403 and 404. Take us through those, would you, Clint?
First of all, a precursor to all of this, one page of fan service across two chapters.
Thank you so much, Matsuen Asun. Thank you.
Well done.
It's about damn time. I mean, you could have been a little more forthcoming about this, but at least, you know, better late than never. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right.
100 pages too early to celebrate, but it's a very good start.
Anyway, what happened?
403, we see Kenichi connected with the technique Kurui Nuki, if I'm sure I'm pronouncing that miscorrectly.
Yeah, it might be right.
But he connects, but it's not a complete connection. He's kind of taken a hit from Koken at the same time. And Koken kind of, like, knows that he has a slight role to play, so he bluffs that he's okay.
Mm.
And Kenichi kind of recovers himself, and he decides that he's going to face him down for the last fight with Muay Thai. They're both going to use Muay Thai. And this kind of, it amuses Koken to the fact that, like, Kenichi's putting himself at a disadvantage.
Right.
In order to, like, honor his master. That leads us straight into the next chapter, where they started fighting. And both of the characters are really worse for the wear. They don't have much left in them. These are kind of their last final spurts of attacks, and Koken's definitely has the upper hand, fighting with Muay Thai, and then Kenichi pulls out the Ah Punch and the Chai Kick.
Right.
And Apachai's moves,
and wins the fight.
And to me, it was a really good couple of chapters for moments. I mean, to me, the best moment of any of them was just Kenichi getting into Tongard Muay, preparing for the final fight. But it was definitely very nice to see him using Apachai's moves in the spirit to finish a Muay Thai fight.
There were, like you said, fantastic individual moments. Not to say that the entire chapters as a whole were any worse. They were very nice. But there were some specific moments which really stood out to me. I mean, there's a lot to be made of Kenichi battle prowess, physical strength, as well we should. But there was one other thing that I pointed out, or that I picked up on, I should say, which is when basically you see Kenichi, he's just, you know, in 403 specifically, he's, like you said, worse for wear. He's breathing horribly heavily, bleeding from places. I mean, he's obviously a wreck. And he's looking over at Koken, and Koken's just kind of standing there almost as though he's just started the battle, almost as though he's still fresh. And there's that kind of – it's as though Kenichi's finally starting to become battle-hardened enough. He's nowhere near finished yet at all. But he's starting to get a little bit enough of a veterancy, I guess, to know that, well, no, he obviously, this guy is just holding it all in. I really appreciated the kind of insight into his development mentally as well as physically. Now, that said, physically, yeah, that kind of took all the spotlight after that point.
Yeah.
And that was excellent. The agreement of Koken to also use Muay Thai, just the idea of using Muay Thai to honor Apachai, which at this point, are we writing him off as dead? I mean, we still don't have...
The way things have been done, I feel like it makes more sense to have his character die.
Yeah.
And I, at this point, would be fine with that. This series has earned the right to write a significant character death.
Is Kenichi then done learning Muay Thai?
That's
a tough question. He did sort of beat a disciple who was solely in Muay Thai on Muay Thai alone.
Here's an interesting scenario. I've never thought of it before this very second, but Hermit. Yeah, kind of think of the path that Hermit is taking right now, kind of going over to Yami, but we don't really think of him as like fully evil or anything like that. Do you think it's at all possible that Kenichi would continue to learn from Ryo Zanpaku, from all the other masters, but then train under a guard?
At this point, it's possible. I mean, they've definitely kind of set a guard up for it, maybe a little to be a possibility, because they've had him thoroughly impressed with Kenichi the entire fight.
Right.
He's had nothing but good comments for Kenichi as a disciple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that would be sort of a bit of a switch for a guard, but in the aftermath of Apachai, I see a lot of things coming for this series.
Definitely. Do you think that would work if Kenichi were to learn from a guard and still learn from the other masters, or do you think he would have to focus only with a guard for a while and kind of blend into Yami like that?
I think it could be worked in to be a part of his regular routine.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's possible that a guard, like, in the aftermath of getting beaten by Apachai, or drawing with Apachai, would join Ryo Zanpaku.
Oh.
Although that would be kind of tricky.
That would be interesting. I'm not sure how their ideals would mesh. I think they would kind of clash because of his killing fist and all that, but who knows?
But he does know how to hold back more so than Apachai did.
That's true.
But he does fight to kill. It's an interesting balance, and I'm looking forward to see what they do with him.
By the way, slight side note, when Kenichi pulled out the ah punch and the chai kick, he had the eye glow and the trails moving from his eyes.
That was great.
That was so cool. I've mentioned
Master Eyes are such a cool like art trick this style does. Series does.
I've mentioned many times in the reviews, to me, there is no better drawer of eyes than this artist. All the scenes when you have, like, do you remember back in, like, the fight on the truck? There was a scene right before he actually makes it to the truck where Kenichi realizes, like, oh, I have to step in. And he's going to kind of, like, he's kind of breaking the rules. He's kind of exceeding the student scenario. He's kind of entering the world of the masters where he kind of takes a lot of responsibility on himself. And he takes off at full sprint to catch up to these villains. And anytime you see Kenichi in full sprint, there's always a focus on his eyes. The way that people at full sprint, the way their eyes are drawn, people in moments of great intensity, the way their eyes are drawn in this series, it's a really weird little tidbit to take away from the series, but I'm just so impressed extremely specifically with that. And you're totally right. I mean, the ah punch, the chai kick with the glowing eye trails, I mean, that's obviously completely deliberate. And that would also kind of lend credence to the idea that Apachai is dead because, I mean, yeah, it's not as all the eye trails are like the last thing to learn. But like that's kind of a little like footnote, like everything about the character that we've known and loved has now passed onto this new one.
Right.
I mean, overall, extremely for as upset as we were. I mean, remember the last times that we've been talking about Kenichi, we were livid at all the fan service. For as upset as we were, I'm equally happy now. This was a fantastic stretch of two chapters.
Yeah, just great technical martial arts. So enjoyable.
Makes me miss when this had an anime.
Yeah.
All right, Arago, chapter 40. And we have more of Clotho, the Black Horseman, being all undercover, embedded in all the police work as their go-to specialist for this kind of, well, I don't really know what you want to call it, but
bizarre. Strange murders.
Yeah.
Special crimes unit.
CSI, motorcycle, motor heart. Yeah, that this is just really weird. Obviously, Clotho has every inclination as to who Arago actually is, the possessor of the Brionok power. Sadly, Arago is not yet savvy enough to know who Clotho is and pay attention to the way that Clotho is looking at him or anything. Arago is, for all the positives that Arago has about him to kind of defy convention, he is still kind of a dumb main character.
He's a little bit too trustworthy, although he has a way of getting serious that definitely gets things done.
Right. We have Clotho kind of staring at Coco for a little while. We might have mentioned this last time. Do you think that this series is going to go in a route as stereotypically straightforward as just a kidnapping? Or do you think that perhaps there's some other ulterior motive, considering that Clotho is already so deeply embedded? Do you think he could try something else?
I don't feel like it's going to be a straight kidnapping, especially considering he already has this backstory and considering the whole fake speech he made about, like, I'll bring this killer to justice. This is absolutely a heinous thing to do.
Right.
I have faith in this series enough to think it'll go beyond just simple female character is useless and doesn't have powers. Female character has been kidnapped.
Yeah. We get a little weird little training montage between Arago and Seth, and the doppelghost is also there, Vega. This kind of turned me away. I was a little bit frustrated with just this little bit. I still love the series dearly. This is definitely one of the top series to read weekly. I highly, highly recommend it to everyone. But that said, this little training scene, I mean, you see Arago with his shirt off, and he pretty much has the Dying Will flame from Reborn. I mean, that I'm looking at a picture of it right now. That's pretty much just the Dying Will flame. Exactly the same spot in the forehead. He's got, like, the things on his arms, which Suna has been shown to have, too. I'm not saying that he's intentionally directly copying from Akira Amano. It's just that That's such a shonen stereotype sort of thing. That's not befitting of this series. I was a little bit disappointed at that and the scene where he's kind of practically... I mean, the subbers, the scanlating team, Trinity Bakuma, if you look on their teaser page, they actually sub it as a joke with Kamehame. And that's right. I mean, that's not what this series should be.
He just shot beams.
Yeah.
Although, like, it was interesting how they mentioned, again, like, the parts of Iwan's body versus the parts of Arago's body. One beam clearly went way further than the other because Arago's body is comparatively compatible with the Brionok.
Yeah, I loved the little, like, dissecting of his different body parts, looking at the one arm and, like, some of the organs, all of which came from Yuan, that are not compatible. I love the analysis that... I love how nerdy Seth is, basically. Yeah. He's a great character.
Seth was a private school student.
The little diagram.
Probably got swirlies happening to him.
Well, yeah, I would guess. I don't know. Seth is probably has enough.
Seth probably, like, killed them after they did so.
He manipulated the time and space of the swirly to flow in the inverse direction. yeah, but I mean, all the little analytical stuff, the diagram and everything that Seth has come up with to kind of train Arago appropriately, I'm still confused that he's agreed to do this, because again, there was that sense of, you know, from the last chapter, like, okay, yes, I'll do this for you, but I'm not doing all this for free. You're going to have to pay me back. And we know what he's ultimately after. I mean, it's interesting to see that he's cooperating to this extent. Maybe you could just write it off so simply as, well, he wants to learn more about this thing,
like,
he's after.
He lost to Arago last time, and, like, as someone who is trusted and as someone who has all the information, it's sort of like when Usopp fought Luffy, obviously it's a big power mismatch, but because Usopp knew everything about Luffy's fighting style, it was actually a very close fight.
Right. And then at the very end of this chapter, oh boy, here comes Clotho's new golem.
Gun Gorilla.
And he tears the hell out of him, frankly. He shoots holes. It says, like, Arago, a beehive, or something to that effect at the very end of the chapter as a teaser for the next one. And that's what it is. I mean, he's more whole than flesh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big test of whether or not Brionok can regenerate it. Because obviously he doesn't die here in the 40th chapter of the series. But at the same time, the gorilla as an attacker is pretty cool. And I just really like that whole aspect of, like, yeah, I'm going to show up and at least deliver a very strong initial hit to the hero.
Yeah.
It's gone beyond just golems being vulnerable dog bicycles and man motorcycles.
Dog-sickle. No, wait, that's popsicle. Never mind. No, it's dog bicycle. You have to say the whole thing. Yeah, maybe Arago does die. Starting next week in Seth, chapter 41. I'd still read it,
Is it like a backwards E?
Yes.
Enigma.
Exactly. So, I mean, overall in this chapter, I was really, really pleased again with the reaffirmation that Clotho is really deeply embedded undercover. I was a little lukewarm on the training scene, but I mean, where we are right now, I can think of very, very few series that I want to read the next chapter of more than this.
I think definitely that was a very good cliffhanger, and I'm definitely looking forward to the next chapter. I definitely enjoyed this one, the whole Clotho being embedded undercover thing.
Right. Toriko, chapter 115, with lots and lots of milk. Tell us about
this
one.
Lime in the mountain. Like, they reach the mountain where Milk is at, and he's at the summit of it, and they're going to have to climb a staircase with man-sized stairs, roughly about 5 feet high, to get to him. Mm-hmm. Personally carved by Milk, which immediately establishes him as a Toriko character.
Right.
Because he accomplished this massive mountain-sized feat.
You kind of get the idea just based on that alone. Maybe he's like a gigantic human / giant or something.
Yeah, I mean that's what the rumors that get pitched around. He's sort of like, Komatsu thinks he's just a general artisan just based on the knives that he has, but Toriko says there are lots of rumors of him being a big brawny giant.
Right.
So, and I guess we get to see when we see Milk. And we get a few scenes of climbing the mountain, a few scenes as to why they can't just take a plane there because there's another giant sky squid in the general area. Again, can't really fly when you got those around.
Wasn't it you that made just a little aside? Like, why are there even planes in this world?
Yeah, I guess the thing is that you can still use them to fly some places, but there are just so many places like the gourmet world and like the squids that just prevent you from really using them that much. It seems like a comparatively less useful invention.
That's true. And it's interesting. It helps to solidify that this is such an alien world to our own. I like it. And I just love the flying squids too. They were hilarious.
Was I the only one that we see this and then shortly we see the monkeys?
Mm-hmm.
The bird was like a capture level of like 15 and the monkeys were like 13, and the characters are talking, they're discussing like, oh yeah, with tough monsters like these, you wouldn't be able to do anything. But I mean, coming off of like the gourmet world, unmeasurable capture mm-hmm. level. And then before that, we had multiple monsters with capture levels of like 70s or 80s. Right. It seems kind of weird to me that Toriko is at all impressed by these animals.
Well, I mean, to me, the one thing that like doesn't make this totally incredible is that Toriko does sort of have the policy of like, I have to eat whatever I kill. So there is, like, maybe that, and, like, maybe he fears having to take out a large amount of them without the knocking gun, because he can't knock without one.
And also, the way that, and I could be mistaken, but the way that I interpreted that kind of a statement, Clint, was specifically, like, this is why ordinary people wouldn't just all the time come to Milk and seek his services. Granted, that still doesn't explain why, like, the more feared Bishokuya elite or whatever wouldn't
like,
always
Match
go to him.
Could probably make it up there, for example.
Yeah, so it does kind of undercut the rarity of Melk's works a little bit. But, I mean, it is still, just the fact that they're, I mean, capture, I appreciate it in this regard also. I don't want Toriko to be one of those linear, like, Dragon Ball Z constant power level rising type of series where, like, every number you see has to be higher than the last one. I appreciate that capture level 15 or 20-something or whatever it is that it was in this chapter still is meant to mean something to just the general populace in the general world. I do appreciate that, at least.
Right.
But then they continue up to find Milk.
To meet Milk, and he immediately shows up by using his technique to scale a chicken-scaled monster thing. And he gets most of the scales off despite having a knife that is, quote, at 30% sharpness. So
yes.
Clearly, in addition to having really, really, really sharp knives, he has a pretty killer technique to back that up.
Right. Well, we also see, like, what was it, his aura that sliced up Toriko's face but didn't do anything to Komatsu?
Yeah.
Is that his aura or just... Was it like an illusion type of thing?
That was like the aura, like how Toriko has the fear face.
Okay,
and like,
okay. That was interesting then. I mean, and it was interesting specifically if it is just like an aura, not an actual like physical attack of any kind, because for the character, for Milk to do this kind of an aura release to scare Toriko but not Komatsu further like seriously reinforces the fact, just as the ozone herb did, that Komatsu is regarded as peaceful. And I don't even think it's in like a weak sort of way, because we've seen weak characters be intimidated by these kind of like huge assorted attacks. Huge, like you said, like Toriko's big, you know, mask of fear or whatever. We've seen like nobody characters be scared by that. So it's like they're all accepting of Komatsu.
It also sort of establishes Melk as more of a precision character, possibly.
Yeah.
Someone who can like precisely target his attacks versus Toriko, just sort of when he releases fear, everybody's afraid.
Yeah. So then we finally do meet Melk.
And he's a dude. Bishonen dude.
Maybe?
With one cut.
Possibly a dude.
And I actually kind of like, aside from the whole Bishonen thing, which, yeah, it's there. Like, yeah. I kind of like his character design. It's sort of like a mix between, he's like a blacksmith with like the shirt that's knit together and like a sashimi chef with the way his vest is put together.
Yeah, I did appreciate that, actually. I thought that the character design was interesting, but, I mean, Clint, you had a point about gender.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was kind of ambiguous at first, and it's not really something that I'm worried about or bothered about in any sort of fashion. I'm just kind of wondering curiously as to whether we're going to get the kind of the trope of, oh, this is a female character. Didn't you know, like, Melk is going to remove the outer layer of clothing and there's going to be a inner layer of clothing that's more fitting, and oh, there are boobs now. And
there is now a love triangle.
Oh God.
With not all guys.
Yeah. That how many times does that happen? I mean, we just saw that like not too long ago in Codebreaker. I mean, that happens way, way too often. So I wouldn't hope that that's the case. I mean, not because I don't want it to be a female character. I don't want to see that exact scenario again.
Right. It happens quite a bit.
But yeah, overall, just as an entire chapter, it was a fun little adventure, little mini adventure to get up there. But it was definitely a setup chapter, because not only just on its own merits, but also because we've had something extremely similar to this recently up in Vegetable Sky, getting up there.
Yeah, I think like it was just very much setup and a little bit of Toriko moments, but mostly, yeah, just establishing Melk as a powerful character.
Right. Gamoran, chapters 67 and 68. 67 focuses, amusingly, for a decent amount of time on these two nobodies in the Ogame school, very low down. They've been doing chores and such, and they want to learn the sword. And they've been tricked into thinking that, well, all the exercises, all the chores that we had you do, we've actually been training you all along. I mean, now you're an official. You've trained, you've grown without even realizing it. That's how good we are at the Ogame school. Now you're a real swordsman or what have you.
Yeah, they come to think that they've been given a kind of wax on, wax off training.
Yeah. So they are later shown at the gate of the Ogame school, where some guy shows up and they kind of go up to him like, oh, what are you doing around here? Don't you know who we are? This is our area. You better back off. And who is it but Iori?
Yeah, the worst person in the world for them to do this to.
Who is the last person in this, literally the last person in this entire series that you should do that to? Even if Iori isn't the strongest, I mean, you would do that to Jinsuke before you would do that to Iori.
Yeah, just how blatantly ruthless we've seen he is.
Yeah, so he disposes of them. So there was a little bit of comedy. The main point of that chapter serves that. Basically, Gamma and Zenmaru realize we're too weak. You know, they're back at the Ogame school. They're too weak, admittedly. And so Iori, along with them, they're all set to go off to find... There's like a hidden village where they can go and train. And it's kind of a renowned, feared village. And chapter 68 is heading off to that village, but not right away. That happens later in the chapter. First of all, we get to see the focus shift back towards Naoyoshi, who has been talking to his mom about this entire plan about becoming the next daimyo. And basically he's worried about the sense that it would give of betrayal towards Gamma, because Gamma obviously was extremely loyal to him throughout the entire Unabara Grand Tournament arc. And Naoyoshi is really hurt because he wants to do this thing that his mother wants. I mean, he's obviously extremely loyal to his mom, but he's also worried about betraying Gamma. So there's that interplay. There's the revelation that Ranmaru has been promoted to the personal bodyguard of Naoyoshi, which is a huge, huge thing in their ranks.
Yeah, they kind of discuss the ranks of Jinsuke's subordinates, and they've kind of put Naoyoshi in this, like, the special group, the personal core of Jinsuke.
Yeah, there's actually a pyramid shown, but then, like, Naoyoshi and Ranmaru, as part of this entire little offset, they're not even part of the pyramid. They're like a little floating box to the right and a little below of the top rung, which is obviously Jinsuke. So he's just kind of this independent, extremely powerful aspect of their entire organization. But then, as I mentioned earlier, then later on in the chapter, the main group of the Ogami school is heading off to this hidden village where they are interrupted by some foreigner ninja girl of some kind who just drops in on them from a cliff. And she's a two, according to Iori, but yeah. She's gonna, I imagine she's going to lead us into this hidden village or
she's
whatever.
She's going to lead into the village. It was kind of interesting to make her a foreigner. And by foreigner, we mean blonde hair and blue eyes, ostensibly.
Yeah, we really, I mean, she kind of frankly looked like all the other characters with different hair.
With different hair.
So,
but I guess don't really that's, know what that's they what foreigners are. I first thought we were going to get a kind of like this village was going to be kind of like a Spartan setup, like the village where they send young Spartans off to train, like the kind of like rough, like make it for yourself, get right. your own food. And now I kind of get the feel that we're being sent to like a ninja village. Like,
yeah, that's really the impression that I got from the way that it was being talked up, first of all, and then her demeanor, her attire.
Yeah.
The way that she jumped down on them, the weapon she was carrying, and her actual outfit. It does seem like a ninja village sort of idea, which is, I mean, that's conceivable, but I mean, for samurai, like explicitly Bushido samurai, like for them to go in to learn their arts and improve there, that's unusual.
That is kind of weird. The two are kind of coexisting, but never mixing.
Yeah. I'm not sure. And this is, if she actually is a ninja, correct me if I'm wrong, that's the first ninja we've seen mentioned at all in this entire series to date?
Yeah,
I believe
much.
So. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure. So that'd be a really weird time to introduce one. I'm not sure. Overall, though, I thought that the two chapters here were nice. It was a nice way to get back into the swing of things. It was kind of two setup chapters in a row, which I'm pleased to have read at once. That would have been painful over the course of 2 weeks, but, you know, it was necessary setup.
Yeah, we need to do something because Gamma and his friends are so obviously outclassed.
Oh, yeah, thoroughly. The world, God only knows, chapter 118. What happened in this one, Drew?
Well, they had to train an idol. There's kind of more to it than that. What we basically saw is that the vintage organization left behind a goddess sensor that senses goddesses, which is like, oh, Festival Arc's going to be easy now, but now the goddesses are on alert, so they're in hiding. And Tenri is thus sent into hiding, which, again, makes sense. Diana's going to be out of the Arc. And then we get to the part that I was talking about. Kama needs a fill-in for Canon, since people will notice if she's missing, and she is kind of on the couch with a stab wound right now. So they get the idea that, hey, Elsie can fill in for Canon, since she's a huge fan and knows the dance steps, and she's not useful anyway. That was a very funny sequence, Kama alluding to Elsie indirectly, all these traits about her character.
While staring directly at her.
Yeah, and then really like funny. Three panels later.
Hakua kind of caught on before Elsie did, and she was kind of like, yes, if only we had a person like that while staring at Elsie.
Yeah, that was nice, and then we saw a little bit more of Elsie was taking Canon's place. She still has black hair, oddly. Apparently, Hakua casts some sort of illusion, so it looks to her handlers, at least, like she has pink hair. Mm-hmm. And then we've also seen Kama got his mom out of the picture in a rather interesting way. She's in South America now.
That was kind of cruel.
A little bit. A little extremely very much cruel.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll end up being true.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That would
We be haven't weird. Seen Kama's dad. Ever. Serious plot would be a good time to introduce him.
I guess. To me, that's a little bit too much.
That would be a little too heavy for me. I mean, yeah. Based on the last time we heard him referred to, it was because Elsie said she was his illegitimate daughter.
Oh, Hakua did the same thing.
Yeah.
Although, what if, go a different route, if this actually does lead to a meeting and she brings him back?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, he could actually be in South America and then we get him into the plot.
That'd be pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that were to happen, do you think he factors into the actual main storyline at all, or is he just a support character?
He's got to have some sort of quirk, but I don't think main storyline.
Okay. So yeah, then this chapter, what did you make of it?
It was a good chapter for its comedy moments, and just the last setup chapter that I'm willing to tolerate as far as that goes.
Yeah, I think you've been looking forward to this dance festival for a little while, haven't you?
A little bit. I think the build-up's been accomplished well enough, and I've certainly... I'm more enthusiastic because of it, but I think it's ready to start. There's no other establishment that needs to be made.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see some very capable chapters going through the dance festival with Kama trying to locate the girls, I'm interested to see his strategy in that, what it's going
to
be.
Right. He kind of alluded to it, but you have to wonder if he's going to change at all since what has happened.
Right.
Yeah, very fun chapter. And I appreciate the... It's not like, I won't say it's taking a step back from serious to comedy, but it is kind of lightening the mood a little bit. To me, it makes, I'm still a little bit put off by that chapter a couple chapters ago where Conan was stabbed, but this is really helping to relieve the overt seriousness and just go forward with the plot. I really do appreciate that. And obviously the comedy bits were hilarious. If only we had someone who loves fire trucks. All right, moving right along, Maho Sensei Negima, Chapter 306, where I think somebody might be a little bit powerful, Clint.
Yeah, so Negi took the spear to the chest in the previous chapter, and we saw him start to turn dark. He lost control of the Meiji Arebia. This chapter is basically, he has lost control of the Meiji Arebia. He's Dark Negi, and he is just destroying Dynamis, completely overwhelming him in the fight. He's just like... charging through Dynamis' attacks, kind of shrugging them off to the side, and then just laying waste to Dynamis and the palace itself.
Yeah, that, I mean, talk about a display of power, reaffirmation of power. Negi is insane.
Yeah.
Negi's berserking. He stopped a punch that was like 2,000 times in a second.
Yeah, that's just
pretty ridiculous. In like then, the way we expect.
Yeah. Tosses out the lightning spear. It's black lightning this time. It busts a hole up and down through the entire palace.
Yeah.
And did he chop Dynamis in half? Did I read that arc correctly?
He kind of cut him in half, and then Dynamis kind of had an attack left because he was in that altered, the like larger than self form.
Yeah, he's like in an enhanced form, so he could still... He wasn't dead immediately from that.
Mm-hmm.
He launches an attack, which Negi kind of shrugs off, and then Negi goes in to deliver the killing blow, and Dynamis's subordinate, an also naked girl.
Oh, good.
A girl who's great. Naked like Dynamis was, covered up in small places by flames, jumps in to save his life, and Negi readies himself to punch through both of them and kill them both, deliver the finishing blow. And then who do we get to stop but the doppelganger girl, the girl who was originally on Fate's side.
Right, the girl who's been masquerading as Asuna all this time.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, just all the former stuff in the chapter of Negi just showing off. How cool. I mean, that's yeah, there's a lot of implications that come with that of, yeah, oh, has he used up too much of his power? Has he let it overtake him? Is he going to have anything left for Fate? And that's all legitimate. But it's just so much fun. I mean, just to see this character that we like go absolutely insane and just tear this shit up.
Yeah, I mentioned it in the thing. We see it too often that a character is overcome with this like dark power, mm-hmm. and then they kind of stop themselves like, oh, I don't want to win with this. Yeah. Negi does none of that. Yeah, he just cuts loose.
No worries.
No hugging the hero man here.
Don't bring that into this.
It runs in Shonen Ace, dude.
So how would you guys feel if that girl didn't stop Negi soon enough, and she was the only one that died?
Ooh.
That
would be kind of heavy at this point, like, given what Negi's gone through up till now. Like, we're not in the intermediary phases of it anymore, it feels like. To have him kill a character now, it would be impactful. I don't know how I would feel about it. It just depends on how it would be portrayed, but that's an interesting thing to bring up.
Yeah, I mean... You were definitely far enough along in the series to have a death of some kind, like a permanent serious death, aside from Jack Rackham, which was really, I mean,
sort of a death, it just written out of existence.
Right. I mean, it meant something, but it didn't have that real emotional attachment because you realize, like, this isn't actually technically a death.
He's going to come back.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, just in terms of length of the series, could we have that? Sure. Would I like to see that? Sure. But, I mean, first of all, can you imagine any of Negi's harem dying?
Yeah, it's tough.
And then secondly, if a character was to die, I feel it would be extremely cheap for it to happen to be like someone who was kind of expendable and relatively new anyway.
Yeah, I would be uncomfortable with that. I mean, this character, like having her jump in was the right move. This legitimizes her as a character. I mean,
yes,
she was someone who, like, started having feelings for Negi when he began to add her to the harem.
Whoa, hang on. Yeah? A female in this series has feelings for Negi?
Dude,
at least one of them.
I'm going to have to reread this whole thing. I'm lost.
But yeah, having her jump in was the right move. I'm not certain. This is classically a setup for a tragic death.
It would, and I mean, I'm looking at the image right now.
It does kind of look that way.
It's about as close as you can be. It's going to rely on Negi snapping out of it. I don't really see anyone, even as someone as fast as like a Kaede or something, I can't see anyone interfering with that in time. It's going to come down to him stopping himself or not. Does she mean enough to him? And it's certainly Negima is that kind of a series where like, oh, the power of happiness and friendship woke me out of my trance or what. I mean, that, I'm making that sound really stupid, but it would be done in such a way as to be appropriate for the series. So certainly it's possible, but it's also extremely possible looking at the positioning of Negi's hand right now that she's done. I think I would dislike that, though.
I don't know how to feel about it. I'll give it a chance to be executed because Negima is a pretty solid series.
You'll give her a chance to be executed?
Thank you for that.
All right. Overall, though, did you think it was a fun chapter?
Yeah, I thought for the most part it was a really good chapter full of excellent fighting.
Drew?
I thought it was a decent chapter.
Okay. Zetai Karin Children, Chapter 235. What happened in this one, Drew?
Well, it was the climax of the arc, and unlike a certain fairy tale, it did sort of wrap things up. We see kind of the ending of the play. First of all, we see Kaoru run out on it because she gets a premonition about what might have happened to Yuri, and then we see Kagari have to cover for her by just, oh, the power of money has won. Basically, people bluffing, like, reminding me of actually a recent episode of The Office.
Oh, really? Weird.
Which, yeah, the one where Toby gets into an amateur play and has his cell phone ringing. But that is sort of an odd reference, but that's what it reminded me of. And then they find Yuri in the locker room, and what's happened is that we have seen Mirage be sealed, so that's now just, like, Yuri's going to be living a life for a while. And then Hyobu's sort of doing the thing that he does, which is just sort of, like, a nicer character. And I didn't fully expect that out of the flashback. I was a little surprised. I wasn't angered by it, but it definitely struck me a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I think that, I wouldn't say it angered me, but I think that is huge missed opportunity and summarizes my biggest reservation with Hyobu and with ZKC as a whole, is that that was an opportunity to really cement him as some kind of an antagonist, some kind of a real villain. And you're perfectly entitled to disagree that he should be in that role. Because this series is kind of being developed as a characters with differing motives and opinions rather than one team is good, one team is bad. But I need a little bit more drive, a little bit more passion out of Hyobu in these scenarios. And we saw him get absolutely as pissed off as we've ever seen him. This scowl on his face recently. When he was talking about all the things that Yuri has done, and also when even chapters earlier than that.
When he finally just figured out who she was.
Exactly. Was like, I mean, he was just incensed. And that was to me, a spark of hope, a real chance for him to, again, not necessarily just be out and out, I am the bad guy now, but to really have a defining characteristic about himself rather than just the guy that has motives, but everyone kind of gets along with him anyway.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it makes sense in the context that it took him a little while to do something. He's not a character who acts emotionally. He has very strong emotional feelings, but he's willing to give himself time to make a decision. I think that's sort of what happened here. Mm-hmm. He was initially angry and sort of wanted to go just postal on her at first, but he eventually settled for a plan, which worked pretty well for him. I guess I can see your point about, like, him not being very villainous at this point. Mm-hmm. I would certainly agree, but to me, he never really felt like a final boss character the way he was set up.
Right. And we've had that discussion again, so I'm not going to go back over all those points once again. I don't know. I think in a way, weirdly, I have tremendous respect for Hyobu as a character based on exactly the idea of him showing great restraint, having the emotions, but not acting on them. Tremendous respect. I just don't really like that character, perhaps.
Yeah, I can understand that. It's a character that's been done a couple of ways, certainly. In what I feel would be worse ways to do the character, but it has been done before, and if you don't like the character, maybe you don't like Hyobu.
Right. So this chapter ended then with...
This chapter ended with the play's ending, which was just them. They wrote a reincarnation for the Nightingale, and that was Yuri, sort of loosely tying into what they eventually did with her as a character in the real manga, real world anyway.
Right. When you say that was Yuri,
Yeah.
Do you mean that was Yuri the character, or do you mean that was Yuri?
Well, it was a play with all girls.
Yeah.
So sort of went there.
That was definitely both. yeah, there were some great, great comedy moments in this chapter, the on-the-fly rewriting. I'm not saying I dislike this chapter. I just felt a little bit irritated with the way that the Hyobu character was being directed again.
I can understand that. I understand your frustration with the Hyobu character. I just don't quite share it.
No, perfectly fine. Wait a minute. We have to agree on everything. I forgot. All right, good ending. Chapters 55 and 56, where Drew and I inevitably will agree that this is a bad series.
Yeah.
Chapter 55. This is almost SWAT level. Like, I have no energy to talk about this anymore. Yeah, chapter 55.
Photographers. He stopped to pick up photos, but met photographers on the way, and they switched photographs.
Accidentally, he stumbles into a girl. Oh, surprise, surprise! A male protagonist in a harem series crashes into a girl. They each grab the wrong packet of photos as they're trying to rush back to wherever they were going. They got the wrong ones, and then these weirdo photographers are really doing some creepy analysis of these photos that that Seiji took.
He wants to bone her. That's not what they said, but
in so many words,
yes.
there was some really creepy insight that the one guy was saying. So basically, for all intents and purposes, this is a really stupid, straightforward harem series. We know that that girl that Seiji crashed into is now a love interest.
Yeah, based on that.
And I'm guessing that the guy who was being all creepy at the end of that chapter, that photographer, now likes Yuki.
That would seem to me to be a bit of a leap, even for this series. But if it does that, count me thumbs down on it.
Yeah. 56, then, is this
Uno
trip
on a bus.
Yeah. How bad is he at Uno?
he's pretty bad. You got to be in the crowd to play.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just sort of being socially awkward more so in this chapter.
So they're all en route to and then finally at a training camp for their tennis club. And that's good. It's being built up as a whole scenario for Seiji to finally confess his love to Yuki. There are minor events that happen that I'm going to skip over. But frankly, the most important thing of this entire chapter is that at the end of this, the girls are in the bath and Sho confronts Yuki about that day when Sho announced to just another tennis club member in the locker room that she has feelings for Seiji while coincidentally Seiji and Yuki were walking by. And Yuki admits that she did overhear that, and Sho asks her for help with Seiji.
Yeah, that was... I guess it's leading us up to more drama. Of course, we didn't see Yuki's immediate response to that, so it could lead to a good moment next chapter when she rejects and admits her own feelings, but...
Yeah, by when, you mean that will never happen.
Yeah.
That there's no way. Yuki is solidly, every single thing in the entire world that can be placed before my own feelings will be. I can't stand that. Yuki is, to me, the quote-unquote right choice. But my God, is she hard to root for. You just know that she's going to accept this.
Point. Yeah.
I will say, I don't like, but I can accept the fact that Sho at least is being... The one thing I'll say about Sho, she's been the one character... for a while now, who's honest with her feelings. I can appreciate that. I don't want her to be in the love triangle anymore or whatever the hell polygon it is at this point, but at least she's being honest with her feelings. At least this is progressing the plot forward directly. That said, it is probably progressing it directly into drama.
Yeah. It's not a love triangle anymore. There are enough love interests to make it worse than that, and that sort of cheapens her. I feel it. If it had just been her and Yuki on an extended plot, I would still be fine with this series, but instead we have Onuma and Fireworks, and much as I don't hate her as such as a character, but I hate what she brings to the series.
I could take any two if Yuki was one of the two. I may like some more than others, but I could take a maximum of two girls as long as Yuki was one of them. But Yuki's drama and all this emotional baggage combined with how many girls there are and how the pacing slows down, we focus on all of them, just ruins any chance this series has of being of being good and of developing any relationship in an appropriate way.
So can we get on to a better series now?
Dear God, it's time for SWAT. All right.
I did ask for a better series.
I'm sorry. We have nothing yet. It's time for SWAT.
Can we reverse RISWAT?
Can jump reverse RISWAT? This is SWAT 13, Yamikura at the end of last chapter came in to save the day because this is generic shonen. And it's time. It's his turn to step in and save the fight.
Sasuke.
Sasuke yep. do a bleach twist, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, Yamikura comes in, and oh by the way, he can use resolve. You know, just
well, he has been training, but now he can.
He can do that. Good.
He probably stood under a waterfall.
He's still 100 years too early to beat the seniors, but obviously.
Drew's just seeing how many times he can work that in.
Yeah.
You've used it 100 too many times. So Yamikura defeats this sophomore in a matter of pages. So, I mean, yes, SWAT is a series that is battling cancellation. I understand that you have to move forward at like an incredible breakneck pace, but I mean, you also have to try to establish some characters as being like comparatively important. Like,
compounding pacing issues onto your other problems isn't going to help.
Yeah, no kidding. So, yeah, you introduced this really menacing baddie with, quite frankly, let me give a tiny bit of credit where credit might be due. I thought just the concept of, like, the afterimage blade attack could be cool. Like, just that itself. It's in the worst manga out there right now. But just that idea of, like, the blade slash, and then there's, like a second delay or whatever, and then a wave of energy in the shape of a slash follows it as well for a double attack, that's not a terrible idea.
I mean, I think it's not a bad idea. It's the type of thing that wouldn't be out of place, wouldn't have been out of place in Bleach back when it was in Soul Society doing sword fights really well, but...
Yeah. I was okay with that and only that. Please, let's not give too much praise to SWAT. This was a terrible chapter. Now we have some new character who is moody and he wears an eye patch, which is just, to me... on top of just being dumb and bad, that is like a slap in the face. Like, I miss Lock On. And let me emphasize the amazing weight of that statement. I miss Lock On.
Yeah, that summarizes it. Like, all the other canceled series, there wasn't really a great canceled series. There were a lot of mediocre, a lot of generic ones, and in Lock On's case, what was a pretty bad series, but... SWAT trumps them all in the worst possible way.
Man, do Double Arts and MXO look pretty good right now.
Oh my god, not even just that.
They looked good relative to, like, average series.
Yeah, I legitimately, like, Anedoki, imagine, like, Anedoki got canceled at, what, like, 26 chapters at the very beginning of this year, I want to say?
Yeah.
So we'd be at, what, like, 60, 70-ish, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine where we could be with a romantic comedy in Jump right now if that had been given time to develop. Imagine where Akaboshi would be right now. We'd be finding the 108 Stars of Destiny. We'd have so many interesting powers and attacks and all of this following that Suikoden-based storyline. I mean, great, great stuff. Even the mediocre to terrible stuff. Yotsuya could have been telling, like, a mediocre to bad story, and it'd be better than this.
Yeah, it's just... Well, on the other hand, Enigma does show that, like, it's not going to get worse for the foreseeable future.
For the foreseeable future, at least. I mean, who knows about how Lightwing
SWAT
is headed.
SWAT will be replaced by something.
Yeah, and we still don't get to read Omaga Doki Dobutsuen, so who knows. But, at the very end of this chapter, Manabizaki, for all you SWAT fans out there, Manabizaki's going to, like, what, train his resolve with the girl? Great. Are you excited, Clint?
Absolutely.
Okay, sweet. I'm
I can't wait for SWAT to get canceled and then replaced by towels. SWAT backwards.
Yes, thank you. Reverse SWAT. Oh, my God. All right. So, yeah, Enigma Chapter 6 now. And this is a relatively new series that is actually seriously impressing us. At least me. I shouldn't speak for you guys. I'm legitimately impressed.
I really enjoyed the series. It's something that you can read in depth and still enjoy. It's something that really takes its power seriously.
It's something you can read in depth. In 6 chapters so far. That's amazing to me.
Yeah, I'm, like, invested in the plotline already and, like, wanting to know what happens. That's huge.
I love the powers, the way they're done. Like, in this chapter specifically, when Hina has... She has a magical hand, but the air vent is spinning and she can't do anything to stop it. She just gets cut. To me, that is a fantastic sense of limitation that I have only prior seen out of, like, JoJo's and Law of Ueki as far as power limitations and... specifications go. It's a really important thing that few authors do well.
And again, like, I can't compare those. I've read all three of these series, Law of Ueki, JoJo, and now Enigma. I can't accurately compare all three because obviously Enigma is only 6 chapters in. You know, we criticize series that are bad when they're that short, but we also can't give too much praise to Enigma yet. But let me say, just as of this point right now, comparatively speaking, I mean, Enigma, of what we've seen, in the sense that I've mentioned before about how much I like JoJo's because it uses clever attacks that might be weak. They might be perceived as weak in such a way, but they're used in a clever way to manipulate the outcome of the fight. That series, JoJo's, does also have some stands that are like, well, this is its interesting power, but it's also just like super fast and strong. So as of right now, at this very moment, Enigma is more reserved and balanced than JoJo. Now, granted, that's 6 chapters versus like 90 plus volumes or something.
That's limited statement, but it's still strong.
As of this point in time, frankly, for it to be in the conversation with Law of Ueki and JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is huge testament to how good the series is so far.
Which obviously means it's going to get canceled.
Nah.
So far, all we can say, it's 6 chapters, well, 7 chapters, I believe the table of contents for the next chapter has been released. So it's not been ranked yet, but some series that are just received horribly are even placed lowly by the editors in the table of contents. So the only information we can glean so far is that has not yet happened. So that's not, like, great news, because we can't read much into it, but I'll take any good news I can get with all these new series in Jump this year. That's a decent bit of good news.
Right.
I suppose we should summarize the plot.
Yeah. So there's hands and fans and, water.
The last one thing I would really like to mention is that the last puzzle piece, they're hunting for all the puzzle pieces. The last puzzle piece is hidden in a place that is specifically designed to be impossible to find. It's above it's in the air vent shaft above where the water level would have risen and they would have drowned by that point.
Right.
To me, that feels really similar to another series whose name I won't mention in case I'm mistaken on this one, but it feels like a character who's very much setting up death traps just to watch people struggle. And to me, that carries its own set of potential.
Right. I have no idea what you're alluding to. To me, this is, I've not seen the Saw films, but it seems reminiscent of those scenarios where it's, you know, you have to do this or you will die, but to do this, you might die.
Yeah.
That kind of impossible or as close to impossible as you can get type of scenario. Very interesting. And certainly, I mean, there's a reason why I didn't see the Saw films and I'm still reading Enigma. I think this might be better.
Just a little.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, just that concept, before we get into anything else on this chapter, just that concept alone I thought was fantastic. Yet another piece of just another little glimmer of interesting writing, which so far all you can really do very early on in a series before establishing amazing epic long-term plot, all you can do is impress through all the little details, and this is doing that.
Yeah,
so
little
far.
Hints. It's a rich series. It's something I can really say I look forward to week already.
I have a question regarding this exact puzzle. Do you think that it was just set up as one of these kind of impossible or near impossible scenarios? Or do you think it was specifically set up with Hina in mind, knowing her hand couldn't go up there?
I feel like the 18th puzzle piece to me implies that it actually was designed out of cruelty.
Okay. Now, that was not the entire chapter. I mean, how did they end up solving this and not dying? Because we presume the main characters don't die on chapter 6.
Haiba sort of wraps his jacket around his arm, reaches his hand up, stops the ceiling fan, gets hurt, but Hina's able to grab the last piece. And they save themselves.
Assemble the pieces.
Yep.
Good moment of bravery, first of all, right there from Haiba. That's a kind of exactly what was needed at the time, and it wasn't, like, too showy. I mean, he didn't just stick his arm up there.
He didn't power through it. He got hurt.
He got hurt. But he also, he protected himself. That was kind of humanizing. I appreciate
that.
That
was, like, a little bit of a gritty way to show action, more so than just, like, lifting Hina up. That was a good hero moment.
Yeah. So, they assemble the puzzle pieces. There's a date on them, and that date happens to be
Sumio's birthday, February 29th, which is an odd day.
Leap day.
That's just sort of a thing. Something that might be significant later, but just a little detail. Then they meet up with the others, and it's morning, and people are walking around outside, which itself is an interesting hint, but then we find that they can't reach the people, and then the people, they can't see it, but they're possessed by shadows.
Right. Oh, well, we don't exactly
know.
Well,
they've got, like, shadows over their faces in a way that looks like the same way the president was being.
Right, they have some kind of, like, shadow marking. Yeah, I mean, they have, like, the shadow trail or what have you on them.
It could be possession, what have you, or it could be, like, a creation, an illusion of the shadow.
Or it could just be, like, they're perfectly themselves and don't know that they're being, like, trailed or monitored by the shadow. I mean, there's a lot of different things that it could be at this point. We could really hypothesize for a long time, but it's kind of useless as to exactly what's going on with the people. Really, the main effect of this is first of all, it's creepy as hell.
Oh, creepy as all get out.
That,
yeah.
I mean, that's the, the second really seriously scary moment. Second or third, maybe, because the way the shadow was talking was also rather scary. And then obviously the smiling picture.
The smiling picture was well done.
For seriously scary. And this is a shonen magazine. And of the three shonen magazines, this is probably the most quote unquote kiddie, you know, not to offend anyone. I'm a huge Jump fan over anything
it's
else.
It's the most mainstream.
Yeah. So for that, for Enigma to be doing that in this magazine, a great, great
it's
job.
It's ready to make an impact on people. Like and then, that, it does scary well.
Absolutely. But then secondly, just putting aside the entire creepiness of this, it shows that basically they cannot reach the outside world. They're trapped in this E-test for who knows how long. Right now they're waiting basically till Monday at this point.
Yeah, just waiting to see, like, it's still 72 hours for the game, so people will come back to school on Monday, so there's that. They have, like, Sumio's diary, basically, as a mission sender, and that's it. But they can't rely on any outside help.
Right.
And to be fair, it's never that easy. And
well, no, that'd be a pretty bad series.
Yeah.
Hey, we're in here. Oh, okay, we'll let you out. Huh. The end.
Da-da-da. Your mom's still kidnapped, though.
She's in South America.
Yeah. But at the end of this chapter, we do see the girls are resting in the infirmary, so they're out for the immediate arc. Hopefully not kidnapped. I don't think this series would do that.
I don't
especially
think so
not
either.
With a female author at this point. And then there's a new diary entry. They might find the student council president. That's sort of where it leaves off.
Well, there was one other little tidbit that we kind of skipped over unintentionally, and that was the idea that Sumio now might be evolving his ability a little bit.
Yeah, because he kind of saw the puzzle piece without really seeing it with his eyes.
So he has, like, you in your review on the site, you said something to the effect of, like, foresight, perhaps, or something.
Yeah, it's like foresight or just, like, little hints that come without him having to sleep. I mean, it makes sense that his power has to level up eventually, but this is still kind of Chapter 6. Maybe if it's just, like, little hints that he can't control for a while, I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I have actually mixed feelings about this. It is too early for a notable power-up, but on the other hand, I mean, that would kind of shake up the entire formula of using this power for a long time and then a very linear power-up of some kind. To already introduce in the sixth chapter the idea that there's some other aspect to this power that's being influenced, changed, or what have you, if it's going to happen, I kind of appreciate that it's already being introduced at this point. I don't want a full-on power-up. I don't want him to see the future immediately.
I mean, I think this could work if it stays for a while as a power that he can't control, that he just gets little hints of it, and eventually he just sort of tries to get control over it. Maybe he doesn't perfectly succeed, but
right. Or what if it went wrong? That'd be cool, too. I would like
There's a number of ways where he could come to rely upon it in the near future and then it be used against him.
Yeah.
In a way that he sees something that is misleading.
Yeah. Frankly, though, I mean, overall, this chapter, this series as a whole, if you're not yet reading it, please do yourselves a favor. Check it out. I mean, we all are, I won't say love it. I really thoroughly enjoy it. I'm invested in it. Six chapters in, the plot is really thoroughly engaging, very creative, legitimately creepy at moments, and it's only six chapters right now, so get in while the getting's good.
Right, it's pretty good so far.
It's a series that's fun to follow week to week, too.
Yeah, I have no complaints with it.
Yeah, about damn time, Jump, 2010.
Yeah.
All right, and finally this week, we get to review another one of the Jump Top of the Super Legends one-shots. This time it is Bankara Sangatoru, by Hideaki Sorachi, the author of Gintama. The premise of this, basically to summarize it rather quickly, for anyone who may not have read it, is that we're 150 years or so into the future, and the greatest Bancho ever, the last of the Bancho, as though they were like a breed or a race or something, has been like kind of like pseudo-frozen in carbonite, kind of. I mean, he's kind of been like encased in a seal. And now this future around him, all these delinquents and such, basically everybody actually, but mostly the delinquents use it for evil, are kind of like cyber outfitted. They have like guns and high-tech lasers and weaponry and enhanced body parts and all sorts of cyborg attachments and whatnot. So the entire world has evolved to almost like a Denocoil point.
Cyber delinquents,
yeah,
basically.
Which that in and of itself sets up some hilarious moments. My favorite point of the entire chapter, I keep quoting this line. Anyone who's read it will love it as well. That's not a booster.
Yeah.
I love that joke. but anyway, it's all these like cyber delinquents, basically. And by a rather clumsy, idiotic lapse of thought, the person in charge of monitoring this frozen Bancho sets him free. And he basically, I mean, there's a lot to the chapter. You see him kind of become acclimated to his new school life. But ultimately, he's kind of the last thing that can stop, like, the worst of, like, the cyber delinquents. The guy who is 90% converted into a fully
cyborg. Into a 90% dominant of 90% of 90% of 90% of things.
This gets into exactly what I want to talk about with this chapter, or with this one shot, I should say. Sorachi is one of the funniest men in the world. Just the dialogue, the concepts that he completely invents out of anywhere, and then the way that he gets so in depth into his own created worlds. That entire bit about the 90%, that was already so interesting. And usually for any other series, that could be like a throwaway line, like, oh, he's so powerful, he's almost completely robotic. But then in this chapter, it's taken completely the other direction. It's like, oh, only 90%? What the hell? That sounds to me like a guy who can't finish anything.
Might as well go all the way.
Yeah, really, you just sound like a loser. Why is 90% this? You're like, you give 90% effort. Just go 100%. What an idiot. That's, to me, that little bit sums up Sorachi's genius comedy writing.
I think it was a great portion of parody. Like, this entire thing was obviously like a kind of parody on like delinquent fighting series.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of like, he's poking fun at the, like, I'm at 90% power, or in this case, I'm 90% robotic.
Right.
Yeah.
Really, really funny stuff.
That was nice. To me, like, the climax of the comedy moments was when he had all these quotes from famous people, and the end, a quote near the end, it's like, I just think people want to enjoy life. Sorachi Hideaki.
Yeah.
A quote from the author at the end there.
He had all these amazingly famous people quoted, and then he quotes himself. And that was the second to last one, actually, if I recall correctly, because the very last one was Bankara himself. And then that's the thing that I also really appreciate about Sorachi, is that he can take the piss out of himself so much. He can really make fun of himself. We saw in Gintama recently him making fun of the Super Legends thing, thinking he didn't belong and all that. So he's great on comedy, but then he also finds a way to really nicely wrap things up by having Bankara be the last one quoted in this entire one shot. And that's it's as close as you can get to cheesy without being cheesy, in a way. That's one of the things that I appreciate about his method of delivery. Overall, I thought it was a really funny premise, funny chapter. The thing that we're trying to do, hoping we get scanlations of all these different one-shots, is review the thing as a whole, which we've mostly done here, but also give our synopsis as to whether we think we'd like to read this, should this be turned into a series. Again, they're not going to be. These are all really super established artists and authors. But if this were a series, Clint, would you like to read it?
I would love to read this if it were to become a series. It looks like it has great comedy potential.
What about you?
I think it had more promise than Bench. I still think it's better off as a one-shot gag chapter.
I think I would enjoy it. The biggest thing that I take away from this is that I would love to see Sorachi do something, do a story that is deliberately long-form. Gintama has long-form moments, but it's also broken up by little episodic bits of comedy. I would love to see him do something that is a deliberate long-form story from start all the way through to finish, but that's not at all to say that I want to see Gintama end, because Gintama is brilliant. So would I like to see this as a full-fledged series? I think I would like it all right, but I wouldn't like it more than Gintama. So in that regard, I wouldn't want to see him stop doing Gintama for something like this. If any scanlators are listening, we hope that you guys will keep doing these one-shots. To those of you who have already, thank you very much. We're hoping to get Moonwalker Limited next week. That concludes the group discussion for this week in manga. Very briefly, I discussed the few series that I read. In fact, they're so straightforward this time, there's barely anything to say. Air Gear 292, all I really took away from that is that the fight is basically over, and it's now set up for a Lind Gazelle-style flashback, which, I mean, I'm glad that that fight ended without too much more focus, because those characters, like Arthur being the king of... I guess King Arthur, that's kind of weird. I never put that together before. That's actually dumb. But yeah, Arthur, who is his own king in the sense that Air Gear uses the term king, didn't really have any particular investment in him, and certainly not the girl who was supporting him or that he was protecting or what have you. And obviously the entire concept about Kaito fighting them, I mean, yeah, that was a cool moment because Kaito's a cool character. So when he came back, that was neat, but you don't need to see that dragged out forever. In that regard, then, a Lind/Gazelle flashback. I mean, that's going to be interesting, but we're right in the middle of trying to get back Ikki's regalia, to me that's far more pressing at this point. So I hope that this is at most one chapter. I hope it's only a few pages next chapter, frankly. Codebreaker 108 and 109, it's basically just further explanation that Uesugi Hajime was not the Code Revenger. And you find out that it's his childhood friend Aoba who's just standing right there, this girl who just like, seemingly innocent, friendly blonde girl. And for the most part, that's taken kind of in a rather, frankly, bland sort of way. She's just kind of beating the ass of anyone, especially Ogami. But there was one moment that was really interesting. Aside from all, like, the you took my love away from me, which I'm assuming that means the one being sought. Aside from all that stuff, when Sakata Koji approaches her, I really did appreciate that the brief moment when Aoba looks at her and says, he's changed you, and she's kind of crying. And that was really interesting because we did know, and this character's been around for a while, even though she was very minor to this point, to see that she thinks that Sakura Koji is the one who's betrayed her, that I found really interesting. And I've never really been too engaged in a lot of Sakura Koji-related plot. I always thought she was kind of just like the moral compass. I didn't care too much. But that I would love to see explored a little bit more. Aside from the rest of the fighting, there's just the ultimate revelation that Heike-senpai shows up, and you learn that he and the Emperor, the Emperor that lives inside of Ogami that's been lending this power, are actually like buddies. They founded the entire code system to begin with, the Code Breakers, Code Revenger, all this stuff, and that Heike-senpai is actually like over 100 years old. So that's an interesting revelation, but we're going to have to wait till next week to see more about that. And finally, Katakyoshi Hitman Reborn, Chapter 311, is just 15-years-old Lambo being all suave 15-years-old Lambo, acting as though he's disinterested, has no idea what he's doing, he'd rather be with the ladies or what have you, which is still weird because he's still only 15. I never got that. But he manages to put on the X version of his helmet, and then he gets these giant horns, and then accidentally goes into the new version with the horns in a different position to fight this Rauji guy who's now like a giant stag beetle. So it's just as always in Reborn, the opponents who didn't seem to have much in common, oh so coincidentally, just happened to be exactly the same thing, set up for exactly the perfect sumo match in this case. Completely predictable, boring. She's managed to suck all the interest out of a Lambo fight. So I don't know, what will we get? 25-year-old Lambo next week, 35-year-old Lambo for the first time, who knows? And frankly, who cares? That then concludes the This Week in Manga segment. It's now time for Chapters of the Week. Clint?
My Chapter of the Week was the Bankara one-shot from Sodachi. I really enjoyed it. I thought the comedy was excellent. I enjoyed the aversion of the delinquent fighting tropes. It was just well done all around.
Drew?
My Chapter of the Week was Kakashi 326. Excellent way to legitimize Tokune as a negotiator, as a diplomat, without quite making Yoshimori irrelevant. And just a great scene of her like sliding out of the stab by being intangible.
And for me, it was Enigma Chapter 6. Once again, I'm just completely thoroughly impressed with how well the series is doing, all the mysteries it's building up, all the intrigue and everything. Again, read this series. It is worth your time. That concludes This Week in Manga, and thus it concludes the entire episode of Beamcast. Thank you so much for listening. I want to point out really quickly, for anyone who hasn't noticed, we are making some changes, some of them behind the scenes, some of them very obvious on the actual Shonen Beam website. The first of which is that my two Beamcast co-hosts, Clint and Drew, have been now contributing reviews to the site. This will continue for the foreseeable future, so getting a lot more content. I get a break. I get less work, so thank you on that note, guys. But also, I mean, thank you so much. You guys are doing a great job thus far. And to everyone listening, please do continue to check out the site on a more frequent basis because these two are contributing some really good articles. And as always, there's going to be more content coming up, but also some interesting changes, hopefully, in the near future. So keep checking out the website. Keep listening to Beamcast. Final Flash.
Less than 24 hours to go, I'm ready to jump back into the world of Albion.
Mass Naked Student Events.
It's called Dickens Dream. Thanks very much for listening. Good night.